We'll call the Joint Committee of the House Agriculture and Rural Development Committee and Regulated Industries Committee to order. We've got a full room here. Welcome everybody back for this joint hearing. And we thought it was a good way to cover this issue. Both the Ag Committee has some interest in it, and the Regulated Industries Committee. We're going to hear a testimony on both the bills, Representative Dayton and Representative Peterson's bill, that are dealing with renewable energy standards. And we've got nine testifiers in favor and five or six that are signed up against. If there's others that aren't on the list, please let Brian Fahey know or one of our staff people up here so we can manage the time. Just breaking it out the way it is right now, if we limit everybody to 10 minutes or less, or an aggregate total of that, you've got about an hour and a half for the nine proponents and an hour for the opponents, which will try to be even with both sides. But that alone is 3 hours of testimony without any questions, and I anticipate there will be questions on this. So we're going to start it off with trying to ask people to make their case or present their points of view within 10 minutes. If there's some of you on the proponent or opponent side that have similar testimony, if you want to have one party lay out the issues for a longer period of time and then only use a couple of minutes to highlight your points, that is fine, but let us know that when you come, because otherwise we're going to have to try to stick to about 10 minutes, or we will be here tomorrow at 3 p.m. as well, and I don't think that's the intention of anybody, but we do want to give enough time to hear the issues and hear the different arguments. But right now we've got at least 3 hours of testimony probably lined up, and that sometimes grows when you have a big issue like this as well that people are here to talk about. So just be mindful of that. We're not trying to cut anybody short, but we are trying to limit it to the amount of time. They say the mind can only absorb, but the butt can endure, and we're going to try to keep those two in check. So, Al Junkie said that. So with that, I'll ask Representative Davids to discuss his bill, and then Representative Peterson, and then we'll start with the testimony here. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, and to everyone that's here today. A couple things before I get started on House File 2532, because I really do want to allow the time for the people that have driven in to testify. And just so everyone knows, this bill will be heard during the Ag Committee also, and we'll be spending quite a bit of time on it there. So if we don't get everything in today, don't be too worried about that, because our doors are open. We'll certainly listen to both sides. And I usually say, I don't want to say people for it and people against it. There's people for it, and then there's people that have concerns. We'll just say people that have concerns. Well, they hate it, but they have concerns about my bill. But most importantly, I think this person is hosting something at Manny's tonight and paying for it. It's his birthday, Bud Heigerken's birthday today. Is that Manny's or Murray's or Morton's?
Happy birthday, Bud.
Thank you. And also, it's Representative Frank Hornstein's birthday today as well. All great people are born on the same day.
And Representative Hornstein is here also. Are there any other members in the audience? Representative Hornstein's here. Any other birthdays? Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair,
okay, with that, this meeting today, Mr. Chairman and members, is a result of the Peterson Amendment that was on the House floor this last spring, which would have required a 20% mandate for renewable energy. Now, I don't think there's anyone here today or on this list for or against or with concerns that is not supporting renewable energy. The point is, and the point we tried to bring out on the floor this spring was that how do we get there, and we need to spend a lot more time. Now, I know that these issues were talked about in the Senate, they're talked about in committees in the House, but It's the Ag and Rural Development Committee, and I believe that there's some real potential here for rural development when we look at a wind and other renewable energy issues, and I think that we need to spend some more time on. That's exactly the process that we're starting today, and there may be some more meetings from the Ag and Rural Development side in January and February, because we start late and the session is going to go very fast. And so if anything's going to happen, we need to get some of these things worked out now. So basically, 2532 is a clone of what we talked about in the spring during the amendment, during the floor session. And you have an overview, and I think one of the bigger issues on this whole debate will be what is a renewable? What counts as renewable? Does hydro count? Does what, you know, how much is wind? What, how does everything count? And so what my bill basically does is it just says that we will, House File 2532 establishes a higher standard reaching 20% by the year 2020, mandatory for all utilities, and that's why we're here today to hear from folks that are for and against. How do we do this? What counts? Can we be creative here? And I think one thing we really need to focus on, the people that have concerns, like I said, they not necessarily against renewables, but they are concerned about, very concerned about costs. You know, renewables are a wonderful thing, but at what cost do we put them forward? So with that, basically my bill is very simple. We just go to 20%, Mr. Chairman, by the year 2020. And as I said, I'll be very short here, and Chairman, I think you're going to turn it over then to Representative Peterson, then we'll have the folks come up and talk to us.
Perfect. Representative Peterson, why don't you present your bill as well. Representative Davids has touched on it, but I think you'd probably want to add on some of the points. And if you want to just stay there, or else you can go to the table, whichever you prefer.
Thank you very much. So I don't know what you all did all summer, but I got engaged.
Congratulations.
And she's right up there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say hello.
She's the red one in bed.
Yeah, she's the one taking the red. Stand up here.
Whatever.
I assume you brought treats then?
Not too often. Representative Peterson?
Yeah.
As did I, you married up. You're going to marry up?
Yes, of course.
And you're going to have to catch up to me because we're going to be expecting in March. So, Representative Peterson, back to serious business, although it's all serious. But
I appreciate the time and attention that you're both giving to this today, based on floor statements that that were said in May that we were going to hear this, and I appreciate both chairs following up on those verbal commitments. And there are some things to talk about, things that people already know about, but what to spend time on and what not to spend time on will probably work itself out here as we go. I think it's important to understand that we're talking about turning on and off the lights, and we're not talking about putting gas in the vehicle. That's part of the difference between renewable fuels and renewable energy. Recently, Senators Norm Coleman and Mark Dayton supported a renewable energy standard for the nation of 10% by 2030. And in that federal energy bill, there's in it $800 million in tax credit bonds. That's a zero interest bond for rural electric co-ops and other nonprofit entities, including state and local governments. I think that the state of Minnesota should explore, after those rules come out January 1st, 2006, how we could maybe benefit from that action at the federal level. Now, some people will say that the wind doesn't blow all the time, and that's, we've covered that. And but I think it's out of the bag on this, because as you know, Representative and Chairman Westrum, the wind turbine at Morris does 60% of the school's power with one wind turbine. And I've done some research in looking around that the integrated utility system's biggest reserve, which is called the N1 reserve, is designated to withstand the loss of the single largest element, which would be a big generator or a transmission trip-off. So, but until a single wind farm reaches this level, the incremental operating costs are competitive with new coal as wind penetration increases. An example, in investigations by utility engineers, less than one half of a penny per kilowatt hour could be expected at 20% wind penetration into a regional grid. An example, 1,500 megawatts by Xcel by 2010 found this to be less than a half cent per kilowatt, which leads me to an example that was discussed on the House floor from the position of the Chamber of Commerce, that what are called ancillary costs are the regulations second to second per meter, the load flow following hour to hour, and the unit commitment of the load day to day. Now, the numbers that were used by the chamber's analysis assumes 100% wind, and what ended up happening is that they added the ancillary costs, the half cent, on top of the ancillary costs for the coal, which you, on top of coal plus its ancillary cost, which you really can't do because they're not additive, and you can't add and assume 100% wind on that model that was in that example used as to how much the cost will go up. So I think that should be something discussed today. A lot of discussion, I think, will center around from the rural electric cooperative angle is that we're not eligible for the federal production tax credits, which for the next 26 months are eligible at 1.9 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, I think a co-op could partner with an external entity with a tax appetite, which would hold the majority ownership, then qualify for the production tax credit for the first 10 years of the power purchase agreement, and the remainder of the ownership would be vested in the co-op. After the 10 years when the taxes are done, the portions can be shifted, making the co-op the majority owner in the long run, and then the external entity gets the tax credits for 10 years, and the overall cost from the wind farm is lower than it would have been if the co-op had been the sole owner. Now, I've been on several, no less than three, renewable energy tours in my district, and I even had to go over to South Dakota one afternoon to hear a presentation from MISO, and we talk about integration of wind and its variability, and I know that there's been ultra-modern updates to the wind turbines being installed in America, that the variability of the wind and its delivery to the substation is not as variable as it has been in the past. And the errors are becoming less and less significant with as we build modern wind turbines, not necessarily using crushers or grinders and flipping them around and using the fast side on the turbine blade and then the slow side on the magnet. So the MISOs, the wind substations, on the Buffalo Ridge I'm talking now, only a few substations will be needed if a wind collector system is built connecting wind generation. And that the MISO will rate the substations for wind power in a fixed process in the MISO queue of about 4,000 megawatts of Buffalo Ridge. And that will occur in about a year, because they do them parallel, they do them all at one time. And just some things to know about windmills, I guess. I'm talking mainly about wind, that's true. I think politically it's very easy to talk about biomass and solar and geothermal and waste to energy and mixed solid waste and all those types of things. That's popular to talk about politically. But the power coming out of the 5-watt plant at Benson, Minnesota is mandated, and it's 12 cents per kilowatt hour. So I think we could talk about the political benefits of all this extra other renewable energy, but really, when we go to scale on the size of the map in WAPA or MISO or whatever we're talking at what scale, I think the majority of it is going to be built by wind because of the cost superior to the other power sources. Now, Minnesota's at about 615 megawatts of wind power from a little over 750 turbines, and the U.S. is projected to have about 8,700 megawatts by the end of 2005, and the megawatt, for those who don't know, is about 400 homes a year. Now, since 1982, wind turbine productivity has increased 125 times, while its cost has increased 20 times. So that's exponential versus arithmetic. And with modern turbines, there's a 20% decrease, according to Clipper Wind Power, in the electricity prices with the more efficient ultra-modern turbines. And what we're talking about is a 2.5 megawatt turbine in the state of Wyoming that is 260 feet tall with blades made out of carbon fiber that are 150 feet long. I mean, this is no puny little deal. Now, at that conference in Brookings, the representative from Basin Electric stated this, that $10 billion in terms of a national grid, $10 billion would build roughly 20,000 miles of high voltage transmission lines in the United States, about five times across, back and forth. Five links. Then a comparison that that person used that day was that the most recent Northeast United States blackout cost about $10 billion to deal with. And that comparison, I think, speaks for itself. Now, what does wind power do? And it displaces gas. It displaces the gas and mitigates the gas price. And that's from the Department of Energy. At the current and increasing natural gas prices, the fuel cost of gas per kilowatt hour alone, just for the gas, exceeds the total cost of a kilowatt hour of wind power. That's from our Federal Department of Energy. Jobs, and I've used this before, maybe some are tired of hearing it, but jobs are significant here. Jobs, 1,000 megawatts of wind power, again from the United States Department of Energy, is 3,000 manufacturing jobs, 700 installation jobs, and 600 ongoing operation and maintenance jobs. So 20% by 2020 is how many megawatts? That's about 5,000 megawatts. Now, our Department of Commerce analysis, and if you went to the State Fair and saw their booth, they're claiming 20% renewables by 2015. Number including the 94 Prairie Island mandates, that's 325 megawatts of wind by 2010 and 110 megawatts of biomass, 55 of which is the Benson Turkey Plant, and the 2001 Renewable Energy Objective, REO. Which is roughly 2,000 megawatts of wind among the other energy sources. But also in that is Manitoba Hydro and the Thompson Dam. Approximately 2,000 megawatts, proposed potentially to go to 5,000 megawatts, which if that is counted, the renewable energy standard idea in Minnesota is awash, and we'll lose billions in economic development, if you will. An example from my district is that of the 143 wind turbines in the Lake Benton 1 project was 110 megawatts, so it was Lake Benton 2, which is another 110, installed in 1998, brought $250 million in investment. Lake Benton Economic Development says that each 100 megawatts of wind development generates about $1 million annually in property tax revenue. This is one of the top five poorest counties in the state of Minnesota and can use every dollar that it gets. Also, at the Brookings hearing that day, I think it's good to know and talk about Xcel, because they're 50% of Minnesota's power, essentially, so I think that bears some time. And from their CEO, Jake Kelly, explaining some of the capital structures and kind of a warning, if you will, what he sees, if you will. Independent producers have developed most of the wind on the Xcel energy system. We purchase wind energy from them and deliver it to our customers. In other words, it's the utility's balance sheet that gets the project financed and developed. That arrangement is working for right now. But he goes on to say it might not work for the next generation because bond rating agencies are raising concerns that purchase power arrangements are basically debt arrangements and they're adjusting their rates accordingly. The issue hasn't affected wind contracts yet because they're structured as energy-only payments and receive full cost recovery through the fuel clause. So the rate case part isn't there. So, his, from their perspective, and this is in the public record, for them to move to a second stage, I think the utilities should start developing their own projects. But that won't happen until everybody receives the same cost recovery treatment. So they're suggesting time to create new rate mechanisms for utility-developed wind projects is something that they're going to be looking at, and they're quite well aware that legislatures come and go, and the binding of past or future legislatures isn't something that's exactly easy on a balance sheet, if you will. And they're just putting these out as things that we as policymakers should be thinking about. Now, 20% by 2020 is 5,000 megawatts of power, and I'm promoting or thinking that it will probably be mostly from the wind. Another amendment that was discussed in May was the definition of renewable energy in Minnesota, and specifically we spend time on hydropower eligibility under the RES. There's a handout for the audience and the members of the 22 states under their state RP renewable portfolio standard policies as to what they do or do not count. And of the 22 that have this, 17 only include hydropower smaller than 60 megawatts. The majority, 16 of the 22, are 30 megawatts or lower. Now, looking to the west, it seems like, and this is something we should definitely discuss, there's the part of the renewable energy conversation that says the grid is regional, and therefore state borders don't necessarily matter. And I got the sense from a couple of the developers that the parochial nature of the renewable energy development is unique to renewable energy, in that does it need to be wind from Illinois if it's an Illinois renewable energy standard? Does it need to be wind from Minnesota only if it's a Minnesota renewable energy standard? I got the sense that there's some that don't really care where it comes from. So it's part of the nation's energy mix to lessen the dependence on fossil fuels. Maybe care is not the right word. But there are advocates here today you'll hear from that are greatly concerned, and I think you, both of you, Chairman Davids and Chairman Westrom, would share some of that, and it's a wide-ranging discussion that we'll have as to who benefits, how they benefit, what are the economic development potentials for this standard, so it just doesn't get lost in the shuffle and go out to other people who might not be our best neighbors. But there is that part, you know, if you look at the XL grid, it overlays the wind resource. If you look at the Great River Energy's distribution area in Minnesota, that's where the resource is. The fierce opposition from the rural electric co-ops to this bill during the legislative session came as a surprise to me, as I represent the district where I'm approached by people who ask me, how do I get involved? How do I invest? How do I become a member of a wind turbine co-op? And there's also concerns, you know, about the cost. And is it cost more? I would say it's not any more cost. Because of the ancillary example that I used, if you apply it correctly, not incorrectly, as the chamber did, that we have ourselves a competitive cost renewable source in the wind. Now, with the changes in the Missouri River flow dynamics over the last several years, WAPA has been spot marketing more coal than they've been doing with wind. And from what I've been told, I mean, more coal than they should with hydro, or historically would have done with hydro. There's efforts in South and North Dakota for WAPA reform that I don't have a lot of knowledge about, but know that our neighbors to the west are on par with as good or better wind nameplate capacities to pick this up pretty quickly. And there's states to the east that are passing renewable energy standards. And at one point, out of 94, we used to be the leader. in the United States behind California and Texas. We have an opportunity, I think, here in Minnesota, if we structure this right, and we have to figure this out, because you're right, Chairman Davids, it is not the same as a 20% ethanol bill. It's not a 2% biodiesel blend. You know, the transmission constraints and opportunities are across many, many borders. And the CapEx 2020 proposal does include a significant amount of wind to be built into that, I think, 6,000 megawatts. I'm not sure. I'm sure that'll get answered today. So there are opportunities here. It's just how it does not get structured that we need to consider. And we have plenty of people to come up and talk about that today. I would like to, you know, I guess I'm supposedly discussing a 20% wind-only bill, which is House File 1561, but my intent is to reinsert the delete all. I don't know if that can occur today because it's a joint hearing, but to reinsert my original language as we debated it on the floor, if 1561 becomes the vehicle for any renewable energy standard. So that is my intent here today. If there's any questions or we should get the testifiers, I'll let the co-chairs decide.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Is there any urgent questions members have? Otherwise, I'd like to get into the testifiers because Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Western. Representative Peterson, I missed something. When you were talking about the State Fair exhibit in the Department of Commerce, would you clarify what you said was exhibited or stated or on display in regard to the 2,000 megawatts by 2015?
Representative Peterson.
What I saw at the State Fair was the booth in the education building. And it said that supporting community-based energy development and renewable sources in Minnesota will be 20% by 2015. Now, what I said in my testimony here was what that counts to get to the 5,000 megawatts. And of that, large hydro sources like Manitoba Hydro would be approximately 2,000 of that 5,000.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other urgent questions? Otherwise, Representative Peterson would like to get started with the testimony. First on the list is Brent Olson, here from Big Stone County, Ortonville area. Mr. Olson, if you could come up. I think we're going to try to adjust this to about 8 minutes of testimony. Is that, you think, adequate, Representative Peterson, if we...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, is that... I think we better try to stick with 8 minutes just because of the full agenda we've got. And if you don't need the full 8 minutes, you're welcome not to use some of the minutes because we want to make sure we hear from everybody. So, Mr. Olson, welcome to our committee. If you could identify yourself for the taped record.
My name is Brant Olson. I'm a county commissioner and the chair of a wind turbine development group in Big Stone County. One thing that came to mind is you're going to hear from a lot of experts expressing concerns about renewables and wind power. The thing to remember about expert testimony is that the best car experts in the United States developed the Edsel. The best and the brightest in government service got us into Vietnam. And someone in a position of authority in the food industry invented microwavable lutefisk. Sometimes I think that the prerequisite for the depth of study needed to become an expert can preclude seeing the big picture. And the big picture is your job, and I guess all I can say is better you than me. As I said, I'm from Big Stone County, the far western edge of the state. We adjoin Stevens County, where the West Central Experiment Station wind turbine is. And we've gained a lot of hope from that because of the hard data that wind turbine has generated. We appear to have fully as useful a wind resource as the Buffalo Ridge. And with the proposed development of the Big Stone 2 coal-fired power plant, the transmission lines, the grid going through our area, is slated to be upgraded already. So if that upgrade can include mandated wind power, we will have an opportunity to do some kind of stunning economic development in Big Stone County. This is not the first time I've been involved in something like that. I was on the first board of directors of an ethanol plant across the border in South Dakota. We sold $13 million in shares to local farmers within about a 70-mile radius. After 3 years, that $13 million investment has yielded a little over $19 million in dividends, and the stock price has tripled. That is a stunning amount of wealth generated in an economically depressed area. And even more stunning by the fact that if it were not there, that wealth still would have been generated, but a great deal of it would have gone to Saudi Arabia. Now, as a commissioner, I really like the idea of generating wealth locally. I would far prefer to extort tax money from rich taxpayers as opposed to poor taxpayers. So that is my reason for coming here today, to get the component of renewable fuels, keep it locally based. I crossed out a great deal of my testimony because Representative Peterson covered many of the points I was going to make. I would like to reiterate that wind power is economical when you compare it to a peak power plant fired by natural gas. It is prudent for us to develop renewable energy. It is even patriotic. It is an opportunity for everyone in the system to win, from the consumer to the power companies to the environment to the investors to our country. And in the political world, the chances for everyone to win do not come along all that often. I would hope it's something that we could embrace. And the last thing I want to say before I answer any questions you might have is this. When we talk about the cost of energy, my son was in the Marine Corps, and he spent one Christmas in a tent on the border of Iraq. And so when we talk about the cost of energy, we need to include the full cost. And that makes the value of renewables, our own renewables, that much greater. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. A couple minutes for questions. Is there any questions from members? Seeing none. Thank you for making the drive in and offering your testimony. Jack Kurz and Tom Peterson coming together? No. If you both want to come and testify accordingly, that'd be great.
I'm Commissioner Jack Sears, Pipestone County.
Well, welcome to our committee. You can identify yourself for the record, which you just did, sign in there, and please proceed. And Tom, if you want to jump in whenever, however you guys want to work it out, that'd be great.
Very good. I, Chairman Westerman, David, and committees, I am also chairman of the 15-county Rural Minnesota Energy Board, whose sole purpose is to further renewables in rural Minnesota. I also brought along, and I obviously don't have enough, Pipestone County Star. It's tough to talk a lot of papers out of the publisher, but I did get a few. Where the, because of the action of this legislature in the last couple sessions, Suthlon Corporation from India is going to break ground in Pipestone with a $14 million investment to start manufacturing blades for turbines. It's a tremendous thing for a small county like Pipestone. It's a tremendous thing for the rural, that just totally rural area of Pipestone. So I don't know how you want to distribute these papers, but there are about a dozen copies here. I appreciate you giving me the time today to talk about the RES. I think that we absolutely have to take a step. It's a step that we have to do, not only because of the economic development, which is a big part of my life and what that does for rural Minnesota, but also because of it's the only fuel that we do not, the cost of the fuel that we do not export in the state of Minnesota. We export about $4 billion. About $4 billion for fuel costs for electricity from the state. That's just gone. If we can do renewables in Minnesota, we can keep a slice of that here. That is a tremendous, tremendous thing. Like I said, we have to work towards this. How can we do it? We can create a market for renewables that is robust enough to provide the confidence needed for investment. That's what happened with Suthlon. We need to create a meaningful market for clean renewables, including wind, biomass, biofuel, solar, and feed that money back and keep it in Minnesota. We need to create incentives for smart management of our energy system. We cannot afford to see the peak grow by 250 megawatts a year. That's tremendous cost. We have to work on that. We have to create incentives to pair clean technologies. We have to create an environment where investments in energy facilities, including transmission, are welcomed in the communities rather than dreaded and fought. Like I mentioned, we export all at about $4 billion. And we together can forage some legislation that will help reduce that amount of Minnesota resources going out of state. Imagine the benefit to our state economy if you can reduce the fuel cost drain. With the right legislation, we can do that. Renewable fuels have no or very little cost to them. And if the renewables are done in Minnesota by Minnesota residents, there is no fuel cost drain.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Mr. Peterson, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll ask questions of both of you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations of the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'll be very brief. I just think it's important when we talk about a lot of having support for RES that we hear from people a lot of times who own the land and farmers. And the farmers I represent have been very supportive of RES, Renewable Energy Standard, for a long time, both first nationally, and we've lobbied for it nationally for a number of years, and we're pleased to see legislation moving forward in our state. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the impacts of wind energy and all the different things where farmers take advantage of them, but it's very positive. I've been pretty much all over the state in the last 2 weeks, been in Jackson, Big Stone, Nobles, Stevens, all these counties,
and actually just down in Jackson and Martin County this week to look at the big new project down there with some of our members that invested in that huge project there. Very proud of that. You see the new 67 turbines put up there. And, you know, so the opportunities that's provided through co-ops and also the land payments that the farmers are getting if there's a turbine on their property, it's presented a lot of opportunities for those farmers. I do have to say we do have had some issues with transmission lines, and we've been working on those. I also wanted to point out, I see the steel workers and different people are going to testify today, but I just got this in the mail today, this Duluth Seaport. Did everybody get that? If you don't, we should make sure Captain Skelton gets you a copy. But here it says, Ports Hub of Cargo Activity, and they have a quote from the USA Today saying, wind energy is great for Minnesota. But look at this. It has pictures of all these ships coming in. It says, here, June 20th, the flagship Oskop, inbound wind energy cargo from Europe, from Minnesota. Norwegian flag Menominee, inbound wind energy cargo from Europe, from Minnesota. July 11th, wind energy Vestas cargo ship, wind energy cargo Europe, from Europe, bound for Minnesota. That's very interesting. So trying to develop, so I'm glad to hear what's going on in Pipestone County. That's important for our rural areas and rural economies. So just look at that. Look at that. We need the jobs in the port unloading the ships too, but we also need them out in rural Minnesota. Specifically to RES, if we're supportive of the different ways. We like to see, obviously, wind is where most of our members and farmers are benefiting from, and we're very supportive of that. But keeping in mind that many of our members are involved in biomass projects, digestion, and looking at how digestion right now, we see like it favors a larger dairy farms or cattle farms. We're interested in how that digestion could help smaller, medium-sized farms. The last legislature, L.C. Marr, had a project to the Minnesota project to help look at digestion on smaller dairy farms, 200 cows or less or 300 cows or less. So that's a step in the right direction. AURI is looking at different energy projects such as sunflower, corn stover, all these different projects. Products in Minnesota benefit our farmers, so we would support that being in the RES bill. We want to make sure that when it's possible that we are looking at Minnesota-generated power. A lot of times we see that does overlap in the Dakotas and everything, but maybe it should be a regional type power, so we're developing it in our areas. We'd like to see, when RES, we're very interested in how farmers obviously benefit from these projects. So we'd like to see how we add value to the farm. And in Representative Magnus's district, the great story is there. The farmers are putting up two turbines to help add value to their farm so they can generate more income on their farm. And if the commodity price is low, $1.50 a bushel corn, and what we're getting for the projects, we're always looking to get more value out there on the farm. And that also can go with the natural gas prices. Again, we're looking at talking about natural gas a lot today. I can't help but think about the farmers right now that are getting these low prices for their product. They're very concerned about natural gas prices this fall. And what are we doing about that? So that's something to keep in mind. We are going to debate the hydropower question at our fall convention. You know, many of our members, I think they don't, when they think of renewable energy, I don't think they're counting hydropower from Canada as being part of that. They're thinking that it's generally grown here in Minnesota, and that's the policies they want to support. But we're going to clarify that at our fall meeting, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, that's the general feeling I have, but we don't have a clear statement on that. And that also leads to my last thing. As I'm out talking to farmers and people, they support this idea. I visit with them. I say, what do you think of this idea? You know, and I don't hear the, you know, I'm really concerned about the cost of my bottom line of energy. They're more concerned about what we're doing to try to move forward, because they recognize and they're concerned about the natural gas prices right now. What are we doing to address that? What is anything coming down the pike? They're more concerned about that than what the cost of electricity is going to be. I mean, that's obviously to the bottom line. So that's why we're supportive of RES, and I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you both for your testimony. Next, we'll call Paul Burke. And after that, it'll be Tom Leggett. Just so you know the order. Mr. Burke, welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record and tell us what your thoughts are on this RES bill. Bills.
Thank you, Chairman Leslie, Chairman Davids, and to the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Paul Burke. I was formerly a manufacturing company CEO with multiple plants in Minnesota, a member of the Minnesota Business Partnership, and on the boards of two other of the largest manufacturers in the state. I'm now a small business owner, investor focused on this state, and involved in several public and private initiatives, including having served on the Dakota County Planning Commission. Over the course of my experience, I've seen cost reduction become a perpetual way of life. Virtually every private business today is subject to global competition and the need to achieve low-cost producer status. The manufacturing company's energy cost is a critical element of the total cost structure. Renewable energy like wind power should be welcomed by businesses that are sensitive to energy costs for a number of reasons. First and foremost, wind power is gradually becoming the lowest cost way to make electricity, and at current fossil fuel prices is today the lowest cost source of new power without federal tax support. As the ninth ranked state in the nation for wind resources, Minnesota is well positioned to take advantage of this power source.
If I put these on, I could read correctly.
Second reason, any prudent business person, at least one that is not employed by a regulated monopoly, must constantly assess future threats to their cost structures and protect against variables they cannot control. Power in this state is predominantly generated by fossil fuels. The volatility demonstrated in fossil fuel pricing the last year, let alone the next 10, is a variable that none can control or predict. While much attention has been focused on oil prices, natural gas pricing, as was just alluded to, has risen dramatically, and there's no question that a domino effect will spread to all fossil-based fuels if these prices continue. Relying on plants that use natural gas or coal for new sources of power is irresponsible and poses real cost risk for businesses. Under current PUC rules in Minnesota, the utilities simply pass increased fuel costs onto their customers. 5 years ago, industry experts agreed that natural gas prices would stay in the range of $2 to $3 per million BTU for the foreseeable future. In 2004, the price gradually climbed from $5 to $7. When I testified in April in front of a similar state committee, Senate committee, the price had peaked at $8. We thought that was high. Now it's gone above $13. While coal reserves appear abundant, coal is a 19th century fuel, and increases in the cost of coal will be driven not only by the rising cost of other fossil fuels, but also by the substantial costs associated with reduced coal process emissions. Even utility executives acknowledge that the coal emissions issue must be addressed, particularly in any new power plants. Smart people protect themselves against unknown variables. For some renewables, like wind and solar, the variable cost is known, it's zero. Utilities that ignore the risk of relying on fossil fuels and fail to develop renewable energy are shifting future costs onto their business customers, as long as they last. Requiring that utilities get started with low-cost renewable electricity is the best way to hedge against future unknowns. A common argument raised against renewable power is the magnitude of the upfront capital or equipment costs. But this neglects the basic concept of economies of scale. Renewable power sources like wind are proven technologies but enjoy limited manufacturing volumes. With increased volumes, costs will come down. It's worth noting that 17 other states have adopted renewable energy requirements, virtually all of which call for progressively higher percentages. These will collectively drive substantial volumes. Common sense tells you equipment costs will decline with volume, as will the cost of wind power. For the reasons I've stated, requiring renewable energy from new utilities will protect businesses and enhance their competitive positions, not put them at risk. Equally importantly, it will spur alternative energy technology and infrastructure development that will allow Minnesota to maintain, if not surpass, other states in this critical industry. No business likes to be regulated by government. But the investor, municipally and cooperatively owned utilities are definitionally not only regulated businesses, they are regulated monopolies. As such, they're not subject to the same competitive pressures and customer demands faced by a private business. A private business must constantly assess technological and competitive threats and evolving market preferences if it has any hope to survive, let alone thrive. Regulated utilities, by contrast, have no incentive to innovate and address compelling issues that face them in the future. If they make a mistake, the consumer, including business consumers, pay for it. Utilities enjoy a guaranteed rate of return from the state government or their municipal cooperative boards. They vote to pass on costs to consumers, including business customers. For utilities, regulation is a condition of their monopoly status. This proposed legislation is a form of regulation that ensures that there's a plan for power generation in this state that takes into account the risks and opportunities Minnesota will face and the country will face in the future. There's nothing onerous or unfair to utilities about this legislation, and I urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. What's your business, and where's that located?
My current business is a company called Hadley House Company, and it is in the art publishing business.
Art publishing?
Yes.
Okay, great. In the Twin Cities area here?
In Shakopee.
Shakopee, okay. Any questions, members? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments on natural gas prices and how that's gone through the roof. It's been our experience, I think, that you can't be counting on wind power to be a baseload power because of the variability. You have to back it up with something, and you need to back it up with something that can be fired up or shut down quickly. And that has been historically natural gas. And would you agree that if we're going to be building more wind generation, that we'll have to back it up with more natural gas plants to back that up? And should that be counted in the cost of the wind?
Mr. Brook?
Well, hopefully there are those who will testify after me that are far more qualified to answer your question than I am. All I know is what I've read and been told is that there are technologies that allow for the shift in the load as the wind generation varies. And whether those are natural gas-based or other technologies going forward, I'll leave to somebody else to specifically address.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erickson, you have 7 minutes. So.
Thank you, Chair Westrom. Mr. Brook, you seem to dislike coal and monopolies. So I would like you to comment first on, is not coal more or less a renewable in that it's a fossil fuel, but I think we probably have an endless supply of it. And if we can design the technologies to make sure that what's emitted into the air is not hurting our environment, wouldn't coal be just as reliable as wind, if not more?
Well, I would answer that in a couple of ways. First of all, no, it's not infinite. And I think if we'd been testifying here or talking here 40 years ago, there would have been discussion about an infinite supply of oil. And time has clearly proven that that is not the case. I think my response would revolve around the fact that if you can find alternatives to coal, why would you not use them? Secondly, with respect to coal, if you're not including in your calculation of the cost of coal-based power generation the emissions controls that will be required, you're deluding yourself. And therefore, by the EIA's own accounting, which is the federal agency charged with projecting energy costs and fuel generation costs, they're showing wind in 2010 as the lowest cost source of power amongst the whole group.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Next, Tom Daggett from Hutchinson Technology, and Daryl Olson, you're on deck.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If to any of the testifiers, if you have anything other than wind, we'd like to hear it too. I mean, biomass, methane digesters, and things such as that, because this is not just wind.
Good point, Representative Davids.
Daggett is not here. He called me to his bill.
Okay. Ooh. Okay. Mr. Daggett is not here. Dale Wilson and then... Okay. Then Mark Eilers and Dan Drew will have you come up together.
Mark Eilers?
I think it's Mark Willers. You'll come up after Dale here. So,
thank you,
Dale. Welcome to our committee. Thanks for coming in. And please identify yourself for the record, and your 8 minutes will begin.
Yes, thank you, Representative Westrum, Representative Davids. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm a graduate student at MSU Mankato. We've started a co-op institute in Mankato, a group of us, the Southern Minnesota Institute for Cooperative Development. I've enclosed in the packet a little bit about what we hope to do with that. It's a bipartisan group. Members are Shirley People, who you might remember, her husband Mark was a representative from Mankato for a number of years. Dean Deutscher, who recently helped start Voyager Bank in Mankato, is going to be a member of our board. Georgia Holmes, who is an attorney in our business law department at Mankato. Mike Miller, who is a professor in our political science department, and myself. The question I want to talk about today is, who shall own the wind? This is an important research question that needs to be answered as Minnesota moves towards the development of wind power and renewable energy resources. The development of renewable energy is not a technological question alone. The technology and the knowledge to construct and finance wind generators, ethanol, and soybean diesel plants already exists. There are a number of wind farms already in existence in Minnesota. Among their number is Dodd Center, Northfield, Freeborn, Tremont, Chandler, Lake Benton, and Minnesota. 15 communities in Minnesota now have ethanol plants with over 5,000 employees and an economic impact in the billions. And this Thursday, we're going to have a 2% blend for soy diesel in our state. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture did an impact study by Dr. Wu, and it shows that, and I kind of figured it out, that for Mankato, that means for our Mankato, Minnesota, our area, Blue Earth County, and for Nicola County, $150 million impact every year. And so renewable energy is a very important thing in our state. And if we do it correctly, like with the wind energy, if we do it correctly, we can create thousands of new jobs and economic opportunities for Minnesota's rural communities. The United Steelworkers, in a white paper entitled Redefining Progress, have projected that as many as 37,000 jobs can be created. And the opportunity present by wind also brings with it some risks. And you're dealing with these risks. Where will the transmission lines go? How will the land owners who have transmission lines on their property be compensated? And I think one of the things I think we need to start, we need to have a conversation in this state. You know, we're talking about gas peaking plants. Well, Mankato, right now, Calpine is constructing a 700-megawatt peaking plant for gas. That means that Mankato has 700 megawatts of capacity for wind. But where are we building the wind generators? We're building them in southwestern Minnesota. And I'm not against southwestern Minnesota. I understand that the farmers in that region in our state are very desperate for economic opportunity. But why? We're doing it backwards. If we started in Mankato and built to the southwest, we could take care of the problem of transmission lines. And then there's the, you know, and then they'll say, well, the wind don't blow in Mankato. Well, our university at Mankato looked at constructing a wind generator, and Dr. Fry in our science and technology department contracted with WindLogix to construct, to do a wind study on our campus. And what that wind study showed is that the wind at Mankato on our campus blew as much as in on Buffalo Ridge. That if you put a wind generator there, that it would generate as much electricity. So I think we need to talk about where we're going with the, we need to put more in, time into siting these. And then the other question is the class, or who's going to own these? That's what I think is a really vital. We have research going on at the University of Minnesota right now, and I've been to a couple of their hearings. But we need to look, who's going to own this wind? Investor-oriented firms or producer-owner cooperatives? And I'm here today to come down on the side of cooperatives. A lot of the problems that you're having would be solved if we would start a co-op in this state to take care of this problem. And I mean, this is, you know, I have with me, if you want to look at it, if you object to that premise, the USDA just did a, one of their monthly magazines for cooperative and rural development speaks about how the REA started 70 years ago. So it's not, it's a bipartisan issue. And the question is, should cooperative ownership own the wind generators? Should we send the investment dollars to stockholders on the New York Stock Exchange? Should the profits from wind farms find its way to limited partnerships where the development is for tax write-offs? I've worked at American Express in their limited partnership department. I opened up a limited partnership account, and I can tell you they're very risky investment for the majority of owners. And I'm not here to say, but we have a way to get around that. And that is the cooperative movement. And that's why we're starting, that's why we've started the Southern Minnesota Institute for Cooperative Development. And we want to work to it. We're not here for asking for money today. I want to say, come down to the farm. We have a farm in Blue Earth County, Needle Township. My brother has agreed that we're going to do a wind study on the farm to let us do a wind study. And we're going to have a meeting for cooperative development. And I would like to invite everyone in this room there. Let's get started, but let's do it correctly. And I want to close with this. The questions we're asking here are not new questions. The questions posed here are as old as the state of Minnesota. The questions asked were when the Treaty of Travis de Sioux was signed, who shall own the land? They were the questions asked when Minnesota's timberland was clear-cut, who shall own the trees? They were the questions asked when the Mesabi Iron Range leases were sold pennies on the dollar, who shall own the iron ore? At the beginning of the 21st century, can Minnesota do a better job when answering the question, who shall own the wind? I want to thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. That was just 8 minutes on the nose, but Representative Junkie's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment and or question on your ownership scenario, and just to get it straightened out, you talked about co-op ownership, and I guess I'm wondering what your vision of co-op ownership is, or are you talking about community ownership? And you say both in here. Part of your narrative says producer-owner cooperatives that consist of family farmers and small landowners who live in Minnesota's rural communities. Then on the second page you say, or should it be owned by the communities and people who live there and own the land? In either case, I don't see an opportunity for me as a non-farmer but member of the community to buy into that wind generation co-op. Are you saying that you think co-ops should be just limited to the farmers, or should they be to the communities as a whole? So I can take $10,000 as a community member, non-farmer, and invest in that? Or are you limiting it, like it looks like in your paper here, to just small landowners and family farmers?
Well, I think it's going to start with farmers, but I've done research in Massachusetts. What they've done, they have what they call Co-op Plus, and it was Amherst and MIT set this up, and they got a grant from the USDA to do the marketing research. And what they did was start up a consumer co-op, and so that's part, you know, that's where I'm headed with this, is if we can get a co-op started producing energy, then to talk to communities like across Minnesota. I mean, I envision the possibility that anyone who wanted to belong to a consumer co-op could join that co-op. So it would be owned by all the citizens of Minnesota. Whoever wanted to purchase green energy could be a member.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up. That's not what your paper says, so I would ask you in the future to clarify that a little closer, because again, if we just limit this to farmers, I think we have problems too. The new generation ethanol plants, when we raise money out there now, we do go to the community. A small town, if you're just happen to live in town or in an apartment in town and don't own any land yourself, you still should be able to buy in and benefit from that technology and that growth in our rural economy. We shouldn't exclude anyone. Okay. So I think we need to be very careful when we talk about how we're setting these co-ops up, because that's what happened now, is we're excluding people with the current wind farms. I can't necessarily invest in them unless I go out to the stock market and buy a share from the company that owns it.
And another thing, and I didn't include it in here because this would get 30 pages long and I would be taking up all your time, but there's the Minnesota legislature a couple years ago passed the Minnesota-Wyoming owner co-op law, and that allows for co-ops to be owned by 40% of investors, and that's an opportunity I see for to take care of your question, is so that we could set up a dual, and that's the way we could take up care of the problem with the tax credits, is the investors would get the tax credits and the farmers would get 60% of the ownership in the co-op.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony and appreciate you coming up from the Mankato area. Next, Mark and Dan, you want to come up together? Is that all right? Mark Willard? Is Mark not here? Unless there is a Mark Willard, but I think it's... Oh, Mark Eilers. Oh, I'm sorry. It was right on the paper, right? It was modifying...
I'll go first.
Go ahead. Please identify yourself for the record, though.
Sure thing. My name is Mark Eilers. I'm with GE Power Generation. GE Power Generation is the group that handles renewables, thermal, and clean coal technologies. I'm a manager within that group in the Upper Midwest. Appreciate being invited to speak here on this, what I think is an important opportunity for Minnesota. As some of you may have heard, Jeff Immelt, CEO of GE, this summer committed GE to doubling our technical investment in clean and environmentally friendly technologies by 2010. As a company, each year we spend $5 billion on technology each year. And by 2010, we're going to be doubling our investment to $1.5 billion in environmentally friendly technologies. And we think this investment will lead to a whole stream of growing opportunities in a growing business field. In particular, we're excited about our advances in wind and solar photovoltaic business. GE firmly believes that cleaner, more efficient energy technologies will continue to grow around the world, and GE is positioning itself to be a major part of this near-term growth plan. In order to assure the success, GE believes we must first and foremost have leadership in both the private sector and in government. It's time that the private sector to assume its rightful place as a major catalyst for environmental change. For too long, too many people in the private sector have viewed protecting the environment as a no-win business. We believe the growing market for environmental technology can get us where we need to be, but industry cannot get there alone. We need to work in concert with government, environmental groups to reward and promote leadership. We believe that government can provide leadership by clarifying policy, committing to market-enhancing mechanisms, and by promoting a diverse energy resource and encouraging an American energy game plan. This starts with clarity and certainty in energy and environmental policy. Even with the technology at hand, breakthroughs of truly lasting value can only happen if government, industry, and advocates create certainty on the way forward and commit the intellectual and financial capital to find new solutions. Brief comments. I'll let Dan go, and if there's questions, I'll defer to the representatives.
Perfect. Thank you. Dan, welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, and you can both feel free to sign in on the witness list up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for inviting me here. And my name is Dan Jewell. I'm from Woodstock, Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman,
Woodstock.
I met him earlier, and I told him that I'd been to Woodstock, and I don't remember much of it. New York.
Is that because it's a small town, or?
Chairman, I'm kind of offended by these comments at Woodstock.
You resurrect them?
Yes, I do, Mr.
I am from Woodstock, Minnesota, and I'm involved in community-based energy development down there and have helped literally hundreds of farmers and small business owners get involved in renewable energy, wind farming as a business and a cash crop. I appreciate you inviting me here to testify on this very important issue concerning Minnesota's energy and economic future. The timing of this hearing could not be better, as hurricanes and supply disruptions in the South underscore how vulnerable we are, and we depend on non-renewable resources that we have to import from other areas of the country. And the Pioneer Press had a feature editorial this Sunday that talked about the need for Minnesota to raise the bar for energy efficiency and renewables. And I think in a comment to Representative David's comment a few minutes ago, when we talk about renewables here, we're talking about wind power, solar power, biofuels, and energy efficiency, which is not really a renewable energy, but it can really have an impact on our system as a whole. Although Minnesota is doing better than other states in energy planning, this editorial emphasized we need a more ambitious notion of attainable goals for altering our mix of fuels. The legislation before this committee can provide the starting place to raise the bar and create meaningful goals for Minnesota's energy vision. We should look at the legislation as a work in progress and one of the most critical efforts we can make as a state, and use the time between now and the session to really get the language right. Again, this is such an important issue for us, not only environmentally, but economically. I mean, this is a huge, huge opportunity for economic development in our state. I think we should focus on what we want the bill to accomplish. At the highest level, we want the bill to stimulate and direct new investments in a way that protects our quality of life and provides prosperity and opportunity right here in Minnesota. We have a list of what this is or what we think could happen, and Commissioner Kears already said that, so in the essence of time, I think I will skip that list, and I will pass out the list of what we should do. If we want to take full advantage of this opportunity for farmers and rural communities in Minnesota as a whole, we need to let our people invest in, build, and own these energy projects. We need community-based energy development. Well-constructed legislation can do this. The bill before you provides a place from which we can work in crafting the right language to make this happen. And I look forward to working with all of you this next session and bring to the table the work that we've done already that have proven that we can take this energy that we...
We just had problems with the House Tax Committee in passing that plus at the federal level. But that's why we couldn't compete. We couldn't take advantage of this incentives out there like you could individually if you had a passive income. That's an incentive to build, and we were blocked from using that. That means that PTC helps make wind competitive, cost competitive with other generation sources.
And Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, if you see it's a distant sound. Number one, I assume you're working to change that, both in federally and a state level. But number two, are you facilitating these owner investor groups with your own rural member owners, like I'm one? I haven't seen anything from my co-op on wind or development community-based wind, or shouldn't you as the power company out there be facilitating some of this in your own home district so that we as your members can participate and actually make the return on that investment that is out there and is real?
But we do have a competitive bid process, and we publish those in our newsletters and available to other people. The Tremont Wind Project was started. It was a locally developed project by rural electric cooperatives members, and they were close to a peaker plant where there was room on the transmission line. They're going to have 67 windmills producing about 100 megawatts of electricity. There's like somebody from Great River Energy would have to answer the question, but there are dozens and dozens of farmers participating in that project, and so we have been. This is a new era for us, and we feel we're out in front of this. And we have been working with farmers as they put forward generation proposals. But we only grow so much, and as it's growing, we're adding that type of renewable generation. We're adding it as it's needed.
Finally, Mr. Chair, my question to you would be, are you constrained in any way by agreements? Your board's constrained in any way by agreements with Great River Energy and the portfolio that they want to maintain and where they want to buy their power to supply as your major supplier, obviously. Are you somewhat constrained by their dictates and what they see as proper as far as purchasing power?
You might be referring to the All Power Requirements contract. The distribution cooperatives do have long-term contracts where they're going to purchase their electricity from. The G&T would have to set up those contracts. That's why if you're going to build your individual, an individual person is going to build renewable energy, the distribution cooperative should forward them onto the G&T, and the G&T can help them work through that process and get that onto the grid. So the local distribution cooperative is somewhat constrained, yes, but they should be able to work through their G&T, and a G&T probably could answer that question better than I could because I'm not involved in the contract process.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chairman Westrum, and to the rural co-ops for coming today to bring up their concerns. Just a comment first. In 1974 and 78, there was a 400 kilovolt line built up. The CU line is called, you know, down from the Falkirk mine into Delano area. And you take advantage of the rural utility services, the REA loans that you get, and the other audience members don't have that option in Washington, D.C. After that line was hooked up, the rates for Dakota Electric customers doubled because the equivalent for every customer account in the distribution area served by what's referred to historically as the CU line in Minnesota took on the equivalent of a $4,000 loan to finance the construction of the mine. It's referenced, like I can get you the book, you can read it for yourself. This, in 1978, triggered then what we now talk about here at the Capitol, the Certificate of Need. There was no Certificate of Need when that coal plant was proposed. Because of the rate increases, Dakota Electric consumers, you know, like farmers, stormed the Capitol and said, what are you doing? What's going on here? And that's how we got the Certificate of Need and then siting requirements after that occurred. And if you know your Minnesota history, you know that through your district, Mr. Westrum, and parts of mine and others in the room, there were junkies, maybe there were people who were cutting down the power lines. And it is also documented that the rates admitted by the company were not applicable to the vandalism along the line. It's the financing of the mine in North Dakota. Now, I want to read a statement from Mr. Glenn Inglis, the CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And for the audience and members, there's 940 electric co-ops in the United States. 12 of these, Representative Junkie, own renewable generation. He goes on to say that electric co-ops are ideally situated in rural America to site, build, and transmit renewable energy to their consumers, and that electric cooperatives are positioned to make renewable energy more affordable and economically competitive with conventional generation. Now, I understand that you don't get the PTC, the production tax credit, but you do have the rural utilities service out of REA, which other people don't have. So let's keep that in mind. And the production tax credit is approximately 30%, about a cent for a 30-year power purchase agreement for wind over the time. And then you guys have been instrumental in developing the clean energy bond, and it was carried by Senators Grassley and Senator Baucus. I'm wondering, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. If you plan to use it, and we hope we can work together after they get the rules written this fall in D.C., and we can dissect that and find out what will work for you. But what I hear all the time from the co-op, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Valley Light and Power Co-op, we're not eligible for the production tax credit. Okay. Yet, we don't pay any taxes. So I'm wondering if there is, and I looked the last month, and I couldn't find it, so maybe I don't know if you look correctly. I'm wondering if somebody could do a comparison. The amount of money that you don't pay in taxes versus the amount of money you would have received if you were granted the production tax credit. If you were to deploy into the sites that you own, where you could feasibly put up a wind generation farm, you know, number of megawatts, we have to do some analysis, but I always hear that we don't pay any taxes and we're not eligible for the production tax credit, but at some point, I'd like to know, what kind of money are we talking about? What don't you pay? And,
well,
you know,
I don't have the specific numbers.
I know you don't have a specific number, that's why I'm in.
Back to density. I mean, let's suppose are able to use bonds in order to build their generation and distribution facilities. The investor-owned utilities, they have the density, they have a higher number of customers, and they have shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
That is why 70 years ago, the federal government thought these entities weren't building out to rural areas to farmers. That's why they started the
I'm aware of that program.
And so on a comparison basis, that's how we get a break on income taxes. We pay all other kinds of taxes, property taxes, our employees pay other taxes. So there's a difference there. That's why we needed the clean energy bonds to help level the playing field. And municipals needed that too because they couldn't take advantage of the PTC. So I think you're referring to the same problem.
Right.
Going back to the, you know, the Dakota Electric situation just proves even 25 years ago, building generation and transmission is not a cheap proposition. It's very expensive. And we're heading into a future like that again. CP, Cooperative Power at the time, it was at the end of an era for all utility industries, and that's why the certificate of need came about. But we were the last one to be built that people really were aggravated by and wanted to stop the building of transmission lines wherever utilities wanted, because that was the tradition up to that point. Up to that point, people were just thankful they had electricity. And perhaps we could have, and there are ways to improve, and could have done better, and should have done better, and we hope to do that in the future. But there used to be a time where people said, you know, dig a hole in my front yard, I just want electricity. Also, I believe Falkirk Mine is independently owned. CP and UPA work together, and they own the coal plant that is next to Falkirk Mine. But they, CP UPA owned the coal plant, and they owned the transmission line that came down in Minnesota. But that Falkirk Mine was somebody that they partnered with, but I don't think any of their funds went.
Right, no, they partnered with, and then through that partnership, a private company received the rural utility service low interest rate, which was then passed on with the cost overruns to the members of your distribution co-ops in the $1,980, that's $4,000 per customer. So I guess I wish when you come to the Capitol, you talk about low cost, you would look back, to the history as to how much it actually increased and tell people where you came from.
The cost may have increased, but I think it was comparable to other electric utilities at the time. And we believe today we're as competitive as anybody else. At least we try. Our rates are still a little higher, but that's
right.
The nature of the beast.
Yeah, thank you. And just one more comment. And I think Representative Junkie is really on to something that I've been hearing all summer after this debate occurred in May. And I'm glad that we've been brought down to the Capitol to talk about this, Representative Westrum, is that it is no joke. It is not, I'm not making this up. People want to know how I get involved in this stuff. And I know nobody has problems that the line coming up my driveway might not be able to handle it. Maybe it's not three-phase power, you know. But, you know, Representative Zuck and I see each other quite a bit. And, you know, I don't think that they're off on the local politics of this thing. And y'all are going to have to deal with it. And y'all have votes on the floor. And I know what your vote is or was. And if you're running around the countryside, I hope you know what you're... What your people are saying when you're talking to them at the county fair. Because I said that on the floor. I'm for renewable energy at my county fairs. And these people aren't going to be hoodwinked much longer about how their rural electric co-op keeps sending out the same thing every month about how reliable and how cheap coal is. For how many years can we do that? And you know, FDR helped you out, put you on the map. Now I think we need to reform the mission of the rural electric co-ops that provided power for rural America and redo that so that rural America can stay on the map and not be labeled the Great American Desert as it used to be labeled on early territorial maps going back to Lewis and Clark.
I appreciate your viewpoint.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mrs. Peterson. Peterson, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wood.
I do. I have a question, I guess, for Representative Peterson, who's author of the bill. Started reading on page 2. It talks about generation or procurement of renewable energy.
1961?
Yep.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
If a rural electric procures renewable energy from a source outside their district, what's the problem here?
Oh, I don't know if that's necessarily a certain problem. I mean, if it's outside of the district, I mean, I don't expect every distribution co-op of the Great River. Here's my Great River on a stick, that's the stick off.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's necessarily that everyone, that came up on the floor too, Representative Davis, you know, not every one of these people has to get to 20%. You know, and it seems like it's reasonable, million veterans too, you know, over here to the west, we're going to be able to, in their territory, you know, in their basin electric, the WAPA, be able to send it in. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that, because somebody was telling me it might be even illegal to say it has to be in Minnesota. You know? And, you know, if Florida Power and Light comes into Highmore, South Dakota, and does, you know, 32% capacity factor, and we're going to put up these turbines here, and whoever's going to buy it's going to buy it, you know, that's the challenge for the seabed, you know, versus Florida Power and Light and General Electric, and the rural co-ops as to who they might want to partner with. You know, I don't think I necessarily disagree with you, Representative Wood.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason I brought it up was the tone and inference of the last line of questioning was that if an REA wasn't building wind generation within its service area, somehow that was deficient or outside the spirit of the law.
No.
And I think what I was hearing from the REA representative was that part of the economic benefit was dependable, quality, efficiently priced power in a rural area where an investor couldn't make sense of running a line or running service.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the feds put together a program to do REAs.
Right.
So now we've got an economic benefit in a rural area. To somehow then think that further economic development would make them buy power that's more expensive than what you get somewhere else, I'm not tracking
that. I don't know if he's that.
Particularly if the only way it is economical is if they can take advantage of federal tax credits and the states and the penny and a half that we throw on as taxpayers as well.
Correct.
Funny, I just, it's like we're going both ways in this argument.
Yeah.
I'm going to call that out and have a little hearing on that.
Okay, just to Mr. Chairman, just to clear up, there's been subsidies in every sector for several years, and, to say it's more expensive, I don't think that's something you can just keep saying, that it's more expensive, and it's more expensive. Talking to Representative Trimble here, those digesters, I think those are more expensive than wind power. And those require, this Hobbinshild one up the road has got so much subsidy money put into it that, I won't say it could compete. And that's when my opening statements were here today, is that I think it's going to be primarily wind. And we need to have a discussion as to whether we're going to be buying Dakota wind or if we're going to be having our wind.
Mr. Chair.
You can hardly wait.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, but, several...
Representative Junkie.
Just to that point, Representative Beard brought up, and I think there's a little misunderstanding, too, that I think what I'm trying to say is I wish my electric co-op was taking the lead on wind out there. Not necessarily owning it, but I just cited the Wilmer School, the Ridgewater College. I've got a lot of people interested in building windmills, except the people that I'm buying my power from. And I'd like them to take a lead and explain how myself or Representative Westrom or Welty or Peterson or Beard, why isn't my co-op putting up 6 windmills south of town so I can buy into them and be an investor and it would become part of their portfolio? I'm not saying that's where they should get it, but why aren't they the lead entity? Why isn't our power, a cooperatively owned power company, taking a lead on something that supposedly is good for farmers and good for rural members that we've been hearing all day long? And I think it's that frustration level we're having with our co-ops out there, and maybe their hands are tied by Great River Energy or other things, but I don't think we're saying we want them to build the 20% in our district. We're saying we'd like them to take a little lead and build something in our district.
Representative Junkie, and to Representative your point and Representative Beard's point, and I think your point was there's nothing that is stopping co-ops from doing what Xcel or other companies have done, and that is contracting with a third-party ownership group of small businessmen, landowners. They can access the PTC credits then,
right?
Because the ownership group could access them. So I think that, to your point, Representative Bood, they could procure it from another group and then access that production tax credit that is the competitive advantage that a lot of groups are taxing. So I think there's lots of options that need to be looked at.
But thank you, Senator Wilson, for mentioning that.
Next on the list, we got a little sidetrack, but good discussion. Mike Franklin from the Chamber of Commerce. You're down to 7 minutes, 45 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we won't even need that long.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Franklin. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm the manager of energy policy with the Chamber. For the record, we support developing a renewable industry for many of the reasons you've already heard from other testifiers today. Our priorities have been and will continue to be, number one, reliability, and number two, cost. And we hear that from our members over and over again in any number of communications with them. And as such, we oppose this mandate. We have in the past. We'll continue to oppose the 20% mandate since we feel it's the wrong way to develop the renewable industry, and we do have concerns about the effects on the reliability of the system as well as cost to ratepayers. Moreover, though, we feel that the mandate is unnecessary, that you've heard examples today of how the industry, in particular wind, is developing in Minnesota already, and the legislature has already taken steps to further grow the industry via the renewable objective seabed and with tax subsidies that exist from the federal government. But we also want to look at the mandate and any energy policy in terms of changes that are already taking place in the energy system, particularly from our perspective as they relate to cost and reliability. To dwell on that for a minute, some of our customers have told us they're already facing increasing costs to their electricity bills from what was and continues for the moment to be a pretty competitive price compared to other states. However, due to the Metro Emissions Reduction Proposal, MERP, some Xcel customers, LXL customers, are going to pay for the cost of repowering two metro area coal plants to be powered by natural gas. Those original estimates were between 5.5 and 7% increase on those customers' bills between 2005 and 2010. That does not include the cost of the fuel for when those plants would be used. To stay with Xcel for a minute, some of their customers already face a mandate, and we looked at, and this was brought up by Representative Peterson earlier, we looked at a study that was completed, a wind integration study that was released to the legislature last session, that looked at the cost of integrating 1,500 megawatts of wind onto Xcel's system. And not just looking at the cost of the wind, but at the incremental cost to the entire system, we were able to determine that an average grocery store, we compared this number on the bills, the actual energy bills of our members, by the way. The average grocery store will pay an extra $2,000 a year, a mid-sized manufacturer $21,000, and a large manufacturer $200,000 more per year for the cost of integrating that wind on the entire system. And Representative Peterson, I see you're...
I mean, Mr. Chairman, if I could interrupt, did you bring that out to us and show us that this on a piece of paper? Because you guys bring this up all the time.
Yes, and I...
I mean, it'd be pretty good, because what I understand is that you added it to the answer, you added your ancillary cost. Okay, well, this is just a basic eight-state histogram, and you know, here's the coal column with the little ancillary costs on top, and then here's the wind column with a little bit more ancillary costs on top of it, and then you took that ancillary cost on top of that and moved it over to the coal top, and then you found the highest customer bill and then added it to it, and then it came up with that number. That's the way I understand it. So if we could talk about the methodology, why don't you continue? But the methodology, I'd just like to understand it.
Yeah, it took me more than 7 minutes and 45 seconds to understand the methodology, but
I'll let you two work out the methodology.
Today, but that's not how we came to those costs, and I'm happy, and I do have a document I can show you how
it would be good to have them.
Continuing with costs, natural gas costs have been covered, but those are increasing significantly, and those costs are passed directly to customers. Last year, this legislature passed a bill that's going to hopefully result in a significant investment in transmission infrastructure. While we support that, we supported the bill and support the investment, we also realize that our customers are going to be paying those costs over the course of the next few years. We're looking at a supply capacity deficit estimated up to 6,300 megawatts by the year 2020. We realize that new generation is going to have to be built in Minnesota and that those costs will also be passed on to ratepayers. General rate case dockets are beginning to appear before the Public Utilities Commission, and we want to look at all of this in context of rates increasing via rate case dockets. Recently, the SMPA board passed a 5% increase to its member utilities, and while they haven't determined how that's going to be calculated into retail costs yet, we suspect that some of those costs will be passed on to the customers as well. And interestingly, the costs of the REO were noted as one contributing factor in that increase as well, and I think there's a SMPA person that's going to testify after me. In other words, our customers are telling us that their costs are increasing and not by a little bit. Also, from our perspective, you know, we've heard a lot of examples today of how renewable energy is increasing in Minnesota already without need for a statewide mandate. According to the Department of Commerce, 11% of the power that are sold to retail customers in Minnesota is already generated by renewable sources. We are already among national leaders like California and Texas, much bigger states in terms of our renewable use in Minnesota. the REO appears to be working, and while we're only in the first year reporting, it seems that all the utilities are working towards meeting their objectives and are making a good faith effort as required by Minnesota law. We feel this is a superior way to build the industry since those utilities have the flexibility to look at concerns like reliability and cost and work around them to make that good faith effort. And finally, as I believe a newspaper was passed around earlier, we just learned that Suzlon Energy is going to build a manufacturing plant in Pipestone, Minnesota, bringing potentially hundreds of jobs, all without need for a mandate. And finally, and not least in terms of our efforts at renewables, we're already, based on the 05 legislation, studying the cost and reliability impacts of increasing to 20% wind via the wind integration study, which I believe the scoping was just decided this week. One of the things that we've also heard today is we compare Minnesota to other states in terms of their renewable mandates. We heard a little bit in the beginning of the day about how other states define renewables, and we think that's important if Minnesota were to move in this direction. For instance, New York and Maine, with much larger mandates, 25 and 30%, if I'm not mistaken, count all hydro towards their mandate. And New York, in particular, gets a significant amount of that energy from Niagara Falls. Pennsylvania was mentioned. Pennsylvania is mandate 18%. Waste coal counts towards part of that mandate and also includes demand-side management, which is actually an interesting proposal that the Minnesota Chamber is working on in a policy. But the biggest difference between this mandate and those that appear in other states is the status of competition and the makeup of the market. All the states I mentioned before and a bunch more that add up to the 22 states that have a mandate, only six do not allow their customers to choose their energy supplier. Those are California, Colorado, Hawaii, Wisconsin, Iowa, and New Mexico. And of those states, only California and Hawaii have 20% mandates. We've heard the relative size of the mandates of our neighbors, Wisconsin and Iowa. Those are only 2%, at 2.2% in Wisconsin and 2% in Iowa. Our point is to say that renewable mandates are more acceptable and perhaps more efficient in the context of a restructured market where customers can choose their utility, their electric provider. The Minnesota Chamber has been working on a strategy to increase renewables, or a policy, I should say, to increase renewables outside of a mandate. And we've actually introduced legislation in the past to help get us there. As I mentioned, retail restructuring would be a prominent feature in that plan. We brought a bill in 2001 doing that, but that bill also created tax incentives to help foster the infant industry in Minnesota as best we can, with a definite time period allowing the business to develop, jobs to be created with incentives rather than with forcing customers to buy the electricity. Finally, just in conclusion,
wrap it up.
I'm trying to wrap it up. My favorite. In conclusion, we've kind of developed a running list of things to do before we consider a mandate. One would be to fix our current supply problem. B, to fix our current transmission problem, which we think we're already in the early stages of addressing that. C, to watch how seabed develops. That might be a significant way of increasing renewable energy in Minnesota. D, watch how the economic development opportunities like Suzlon pan out. See if the REO is working, and all indications seem to be that it is. Complete the 20% integration study required by the 2005 law, which will be finished in about a year, and allow customers to shop for electricity. The Minnesota Chamber feels that we don't need a renewable mandate because we're already national leaders. Minnesota's electricity policy should address reliability and cost first before addressing other objectives. Our members tell us that reliability is of the utmost importance and costs are increasing and not in small doses. and also that comparisons of this mandate to other states may be unfair, that it's bigger, more restrictive, and not in the context of an electricity market. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and thank you for the chamber, Minnesota Chamber, for being here. But I just point out, too, that while I certainly don't speak for all the chambers and business groups across the state, I don't think the Minnesota Chamber does either. In fact, I know they don't. And while we may bristle at mandates, and certainly a lot the folks in the legislature do, in some ways they've worked very well for a lot of our areas that support chambers and their business. Just a note that the Minnesota Chamber did not support ethanol either. And now we have 14 plants going on 16, and they're growing and expanding, and it's a governor's initiative. And that was a good deal for a lot of chambers and business people in that $1.3 billion industry that's grown in rural Minnesota. I don't think the chamber, Minnesota Chamber, supported biodiesel mandate, which is taking effect on Thursday. But I know that the chambers probably in Albert Lea and the Brewster area and Redwood Falls are pretty happy that that industry was mandated in rural Minnesota. And again, I think that'll be true with wind and renewables too, that particularly in rural Minnesota, where all our businesses and actually our local chambers are not members of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, I just want to point out that they're not a uniform voice for the business industry across the state, that there's a lot of local chambers and business folks that are extremely excited about some of the mandates that have been put in place the last few years when it pertains to energy production in this state. So I want to get that on the table, because too often, and I appreciate you being here, and I do respect your views, but too often we only hear from the Minnesota Chamber, and we don't hear from some of the smaller individual chambers across the state that really support this kind of development in business and mandates.
Representative Moe, and then just a quick, I'd like Karen and Larry Johnson, I'm going to call you both up together if it's possible to combine a little of your testimony, but just so you know, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Franklin, I too appreciate your advocacy for affordable power for all of business across the state of Minnesota. I too share Representative Junkie's concern. My local chamber, for which I'm a member, has most of its members are outdoor recreation, fishing related tourism businesses or related to them in some way. And being that we have currently over 75% of our electricity coming from coal generation, that leaves large mercury deposits in many of our lakes, that is proving to be a greater and greater problem for our area, in that fishermen come up to my district to stay in our hotels, yet there's fish advisories on every single lake we have. And first I'd like you to respond to that. If when you're talking about an amount, how much more this costs business to add renewable energies, energy mandates to their to the production, does the chamber consider the economic impact to things like mercury contamination in the water and how that affects the businesses in my district? And so I'd like to answer that question. And the second is how would you propose that we address that concern? In my view, the chamber should represent tourism in Minnesota. Yet if we can't come up to Bemidji or Walker or some other place and catch the fish and eat them, they're going to start to go somewhere else. And I'm guessing the chamber would care about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moe, there are instances in which local chambers and the Minnesota Chamber, just in response, don't see eye to eye on certain policies. Our challenge is to do our best to listen to our 2,600 statewide members and represent them here. In response to Representative Moe, yes, the short answer is yes. We do see the, and I'm not to pop out, I'm not the environmental policy lobbyist, but we do have an environmental effort which is dealing right now with the effects of mercury. And in the 05 session, we did support the Clean Water Legacy Act, that actually support the funding mechanism. Actually, we volunteered a sliding scale where customers would pay based on use. However, when sticking with energy policy, we do think that the externalities need to be factored in, but that when setting energy policy, we think reliability needs to be the number one concern, and then cost. So I hope that answers your question.
Just a follow-up, Representative Moore. I guess then I would ask you, when you consider cost, it's not just short-term cost, but you consider long-term cost, especially long-term cost for businesses in greater Minnesota, especially when it's related to fishing-related tourism. Initial cost right at the source does not reflect whether people are going to come up to my district and fish or not.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Franklin. Mine kind of follows the same line of questioning as Representative Moe, and before I start that, I just want to encourage you to maybe that you should talk with your environmental lobbyist with the chamber, because during the legacy discussion, I asked specifically if the clean water legacy proposal would affect mercury, and the answer from the chamber lobbyist was no, that it would not be cleaning up mercury. And so I think that energy and environment go hand in hand, and that I would encourage you to start talking with each other because I think that's where the key issue comes in. On that issue, I'd like you did talk about increase in cost to customers, the Xcel customers, from transferring from coal to natural gas, and we heard earlier about natural gas cost increasing, and that maybe wind could take some of that as an alternative. But the Pollution Control Agency is working on a TMDL plan for mercury right now, and I'm wondering what is the chamber's position on the TMDLs for mercury, if that relates to, as the energy lobbyist for the chamber, if you are aware of what the chamber's position is on mercury reduction through the TMDLs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't know the specifics of our plan of our position on the TMDL plan. I apologize. I will make sure someone gets in contact with you and the committee. But you bring up an interesting point with respect to renewables becoming more cost-effective by comparison, as the externalities associated with environmental costs are worked into the system. And we've already seen some instances where wind, assuming federal tax subsidies, is a cheaper energy source than others that may be out there, which is why we support the industry and don't see the need for a mandate. As it becomes more cost competitive by comparison, we think that utilities and customers will begin to demand it as a least cost alternative as the market develops.
Representative Powell, and then we're going to move to the next testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard a lot today, and I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Franklin. We've heard a lot today about economic development in rural areas. And a lot of members around the table here from the rural areas and are very concerned about advocating for the constituencies. And I understand that, because right now I'm going to advocate for mine. I represent Burnsville. City of Burnsville is the 10th largest city in the state of Minnesota. We're the 8th largest manufacturer. We are the 4th largest retailer. We have one of the largest school systems in the state. Consequently, we use an awful lot of electricity. And when I hear figures such as came through in the Department of Commerce report that Xcel Energy participated in November of last year, that shows these large costs that can come from integration of a large amount of renewables into our system, then that gives me a great deal of pause. And then I have to sit and say to my friends across greater Minnesota is that maybe I'm not so interested in having electrical generation just becoming another electric economic development program for another part of the state. This is important for our economic engine here. So I think that the message that we're getting from the chamber here is important for us to consider seriously. And that's why I'm so interested in the wind integration project that's going on now at the PUC. And they're going to do that right, as far as I'm as far as I know. And we're going to get some solid answers about costs and how we can integrate wind into our current mix of energy generation. It's very, very important. The stakes are extremely great for people in my position and my constituencies. And we're just, and I think that people just need to understand that cost and reliability, for, especially from my perspective, has to be number one and number two in how we move forward on this. I just wanted to get that on the table. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, Mr. President Peterson.
Yeah, I can make it quick.
Thank you, Chairman. And I just want to think, yeah, we've got a ways to go. We're going to get that number. But I did say earlier that it's a half a cent, you know, which is, I think, comparable with any new coal that you would implement off of this CapEx type deal to meet the load growth in your area, potentially. So I just think that, you know, it's, when you say it costs more, I'm going to say it doesn't cost more.
It's not me saying that.
Yeah, but it gets said, and I can't let that go about it, or it costs more. And I know it doesn't blow all the time. So, yeah, we have that part figured out. I think we're way past that. But for new energy technologies in the future that are going to have to deal with low growth in your district, I think that rural Minnesota and the going west are going to really take the edge off of what could, without renewables, be big boats coming across the ocean with natural gas on them. Now, we don't have any of that here. You know, the Wall Street decided that gas prices were going to go up, and they've gone up. And I'd rather not pay them. I'd rather knock it down with some wind that's deployable, and if we had a standard, you know, we can maybe work on the standard. You know, 60%, I'm sorry, you're getting tired of this, Representative Westrom, I know, but 60% out of the University of Minnesota Morris, and it's not even the windiest part of the state. I mean, that's not spin, there's no partisanship in that, that's just a fact. I mean, it's out of the bag, it's really a good deal.
Mr. Chair, member, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. We will move to our next two testifiers, which will become our last two testifiers. Karen Hyde and Larry Johnston. Karen from Excel and Larry Johnston from SIMPA. We'll combine you.
Okay, that's fine.
We need to try to be out of this room at 5 o'clock, so that's the time you got.
Okay. Chairman Westrom and Chair Davis, my name is Karen Hyde, and I'm the Director of Purchased Power with Xcel Energy. I'm responsible for purchasing all of the renewable energy that Xcel purchases for its system. We're pleased to participate in these discussions today, and we're pleased to help Minnesota become less dependent on outside sources of energy. We think there are a lot of challenges to overcome first, though. Xcel Energy is a leader in the use of renewable energy. The American Wind Energy Association currently ranks us twice second among buyers of wind energy for our customers. As we go through the next 2 years, we plan to be number one, the number one buyer in the United States. In Minnesota, we're moving forward in burning biomass and hydropower and wind energy. Right now, we think that there's about 9.5% of our energy is produced by those renewable resources, and that does not count Manitoba Hydro. As the new resources come on, the Buffalo Ridge and the Turkular plant in Benson and the new projects in Hibbing and Virginia will be at about 16 to 17% of our energy will be produced by renewable resources. We understand that you want to continue on the path toward renewable energy. We want to point out a couple of things. First is that because we have resources that are renewable resources that are outside of the renewable energy objective, doubling the renewable energy objective for the state actually makes it about a 30% requirement for us under the way the current legislation is structured. So I think you have to kind of think about even higher, you know, the effect of higher penetration than you're actually even talking about today. To date, the Department of Commerce study, you know, I think we've talked about that a lot, that showed the half a cent. One thing that I want to point out that hasn't been discussed yet today is that when we did that first study for Minnesota, we had about a 3% penetration of wind energy. We came up with $1.86 a megawatt hour for the ancillary services. We then looked on our Texas system at about a 10% penetration. We came up with $2.50, so we thought we're kind of evened out there. When we did the study in Minnesota and we confirmed it on a study in Colorado, we came out right around $5 a megawatt hour for 15%. So we saw a pretty steep increase in the integration cost of wind between 10 and 15%. So I'm really interested to see what's going to be in the 20% penetration study. So we see if we're at another kind of leveling out point or if we're at another point where we're going to see the costs go up. I think the cost, just so you know, we're clear, the costs kind of fall into two buckets. One is those costs associated with, as Representative Peterson brought out, the unit commitment, the load following, and the regulation. And those are the costs that are associated with the uncertainty of whether the wind will blow at any point in time. Some of that you can accommodate by forecasting, some not. The other technical issue is, I think, as some of you brought up, the issue of needing to meet your load when your customers demand that. And right now, in general, our system is still summer peaking in Minnesota, and the wind is generally not blowing that much when we summer peak. So we do have to have other resources standing by, and they can be, you know, as Darrellyn presented, you can use renewable resources that are non-wind to help fill that in. But in general, you're going to have probably gas-fired resources. And it's gas-fired resources that drive the economics of wind right now. I think one of the other issues that hasn't been counted too much to date in this session was the issue of that large parts of our service territory include the Dakotas and Wisconsin. And like Darrellyn, I think we want to advocate that as a legislature, you look to a broader range. You know, consider that your utilities are serving other areas. And we are part of the Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System Group. We're looking to be able to trade credits between the states and looking to see how we can meet all of our states' requirements kind of in cooperation with each other. I did bring up the question of counting different resources. We have, I think, as you know, biomass and wind resources that fall outside of the current REO. I think that causes some confusion with the public, and it certainly causes confusion within our organization. So as you look to a larger standard, it would be nice if that could be a simplified standard that would let all renewable energy count in the state. I think that there's also a lot of questions about, you know, like I said, the integration study, and we're really looking forward to seeing that completed. And we look forward to participating and contributing to the discussion, and we welcome others who want to work alongside us to craft a responsible, renewable energy future for Minnesota. So I cut out big sections, just so you know, in order to meet your goal of 5 o'clock.
Okay.
What is that what you have right now?
Yeah,
right. Why don't we have Larry present the point, and then we'll open up for just
sure. Thank you, Chairman Westerman, committee members. I'm going to take just a minute of your time. I represent Southern Minnesota Municipal Utility and Power Agency, and we serve 18 municipal utilities around the state. Now, last year, there was a huge, large stakeholder group that worked with this law that had the 20% wind integration study in it. And it was a large stakeholder group. It had utilities in it. It had citizen representatives in it. It had environmental representatives in it. There were three charges in that. Those charges were to take a look at any reliability issues in moving to 20% of retail sales. They were to look at techniques for helping utilities mitigate intermittency, conceivably forecasting more than anything. And the third issue was that the costs that were identified in looking at the total cost of making that move to 20% of retail load was to be used and reported to the DOC in terms of the rate impact that it was going to have on the individual utilities, and it was to be used in their integrated resource plans on a go-forward basis. Now, Ken Wolf, the reliability administrator, said it better than anyone I've heard say it yet. We need scientific answers to political questions. That is exactly what we have talked about for the last 4 hours. Yeah. All right. I caution you to set new targets before we have the results of that study. I was at the first broad-based scoping piece of that, and some of you, maybe not. I was thinking some of you might have been in the room. If there was a consensus in the room that day, it was that the study scope probably needed to be broader than people first thought it was, and how in the dickens were we going to get the answers to those three questions by November of 06. Everyone in the room of the large stakeholder group wanted to increase the scope because they saw more questions than answers with heading down this path. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions, members? Representative
Powell. Real quickly, for Excel here, how much natural gas do you import to generate electricity?
Mm-hmm.
And where does that come from?
I'll have to
decide.
I'm sorry, I'll have to get the actual number for you. Can I have our representative give it to you?
Is it?
Thank okay, thank you.
What was that question again, Representative Powell? What did you...
I just wanted to know just how much natural gas is imported for electrical generation and where
okay.
they come from.
Why don't you get that to Brian and he can get it to the committee.
Okay.
Email it to him or however. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thing is hide for your testimony and being brief so you can get a couple questions in here. In regards to the question I asked Mr. Franklin earlier about mercury contamination, I know XL being the largest energy producer service in Minnesota and one of the largest in the country, and that mercury contamination in our lakes is a global problem, obviously. It's not completely, obviously not just solely due to generation here in Minnesota. Does XL Energy have a strategy to deal with that at all? I mean, we dealt with acid rain nationally, first by leading in Minnesota, and then the world followed. This is a hugely important issue to northern Minnesota, and I ask if XL Energy has a strategy for that. How are you planning on dealing with that? And just I want to remind you, you did say responsible renewable energy is your goal, and so this would obviously be responsible in my book.
Ms. Hyde.
Yes, obviously, more renewable energy will contribute to our plans to reduce mercury and carbon emissions and other emissions. I believe that that's been addressed in our resource plan that would be comments are due in late October, so I think that's addressed in more detail in that plan.
Okay.
Can I get that to you too? Okay. Okay. I'm obviously not the mercury expert in the company.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hyde. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm not a mercury expert either, but it's been splashed around here a little bit the last couple of years. And if mercury is a concern, it occurs naturally in the environment, apparently is released whenever we burn coal. Mm-hmm. We've engineered our way out of sulfur and nitrogen and fine particulate matter just by what we've been able to do mechanically and so on and so forth, sometimes chemically. But it appears, just for Representative Moe and others that have raised the mercury issue, that engineering mercury out of flue gas is, we haven't found the silver bullet yet to make that happen. There are, however, a couple other ways we can generate electricity that are reliable, dependable, and high quality, and economical, that don't emit any mercury at all. First one that comes to mind is nuclear power. There we don't even get carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Or we can talk about coal gasification, what's known as a clean coal technology, where it takes out something in excess of 97% of all the mercury that would go into the environment, doesn't go into the environment anymore whenever we treat the coal before we burn it. You know, by the way, the cool benefit of that is you get natural gas or synthetic gas that can go into a peaking plant. Hopefully, it's somewhat less than what natural gas rates are. So just so we're talking about mercury here, know that there are some things that are going on with that, but somehow getting it out of traditional combustion coal-powered plants has been scientifically impossible. It's the ring everybody's trying to grab, and we just haven't been able to get it yet. But if you're serious about it, we can talk about nuclear power.
Well, I'm Representative Beard. I'm Representative Moe. Groups also tell me that it's naturally occurring in some of our lakes, and they aren't even sure why it occurs. So some of it might be that, but a bigger issue than we can tackle today because we are about out of time. Representative Peterson, any final
questions? Just a quick question. Thank you for your patience, Chairman Westerman, members and audience. You made a statement, gas drives wind. I think that's what I wrote that down. Or something like that. To that effect. And I don't know, I'm just wondering, I've heard people talk about that gas, in repeating, where it is in place, gas is one reason transmission is not being built. Would you comment on that? And also, the 20% by 2020, that would put 30% penetration on for wind on your system. So we should be talking about more than 20% penetration as the legislation is structured, and that's for the Xcel service territory?
No, what I meant from that was that when you talk about a 20% statewide REO,
yeah,
the result is going to be more than 20% penetration if you leave the standards the way they are today. So okay, you're actually even then stepping out ahead of the 20% test.
Under the REO that Commerce is looking at.
Uh-huh. So I think you're stepping out even further okay than where we are today. On the gas issue, I did say that. That does the economics of wind.
Okay, thank you.
Cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
So you need the more gas you can offset with wind generation on the system, the more favorable the economics are toward picking wind.
Correct.
And that's largely why we've been choosing wind.
Right, and mm-hmm, a lot of wind.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Okay, thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you, both Ag and Regulated Industries Committee members. A good discussion, a good a start of discussion on a subject that is, as we knew coming into it, but reaffirmed today, has many facets, many controversial points to it, and we will continue to dig into this issue in the future. And so with that, leave your folders on the table. They'll be picked up and garbage on the outside ring, and the meeting is adjourned.
Energy that we have and turned it into a real live economic development tool for a substantial development in Minnesota and really keep our energy dollars here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Did you get those papers passed?
Yeah,
I'll give them to the end of the table and they can pass them around.
Okay.
Representative Peterson and then Thiessen.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Westrom, and to Mr. Irish first and then to Mr. Toole. Representative Paul earlier in the hearing talked about the dispatch. You cannot dispatch the wind. You can't tell it when to go and to take care of a peak or something. You have to back it up. Your General Electric... Well, if you don't know, General Electric came in after Enron in Lincoln County and now runs 210 megawatts in Lincoln County. So they've got what they call the Volt Amp Reactive Wind Turbine.
We need to come up with their name, don't we?
Yeah, VAR. And to that point, maybe you could explain the gains and efficiencies realized by your technology and your company that would impact those comments about the supposed renewability of coal and the like.
Two questions. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Thank you.
Explain
But the advances in wind turbines have come as a result of necessity. When we were 5-6 turbines out in the field, it didn't matter with the noise on the system. We're building 300-400 megawatt wind farms that are end of transmission systems. Utilities have to have reliability. They insist on reliability. The blackouts only require that every technology on the grid be a good citizen. GE, with its research and development arm, has created, I think, some of the leading technologies to be able to ride through system disturbances such that if you have a power plant that goes out, you will not have 400 megawatts of wind go out. We'll be able to ride through those system disturbances and support the system. We are now a good citizen on the grid. And I can say the old stuff wasn't, but when you were only 3 or 4 turbines, you didn't have to. 300 megawatts, you have to. So we've made significant advances technologically to become a good citizen with low voltage ride through and a reactive power, which I won't bore you through. But I was recently up at an Otter Tail Power meeting in Fergus Falls, and the person I was talking to couldn't speak well enough of the system stability that our wind farm in North Dakota brought to their grid, and he was just tickled and was happy to have more of it. Can't say that would happen every time, but we are no longer the anger of utilities when we're on the grid. Second question as to the renewability of coal. I don't think anyone would say coal is renewable. We have about 350 years of coal. That is a long time given our short-term society. But we are investing in clean coal technologies, such as you see up on the Iron Range, the IGCC. But it's not cheap. And to get clean coal-based energy, you're not going to be, it will be about 20%, maybe 30% more expensive. So I still think even if you build clean coal, wind still has an economic, adds economic value to the grid as a diverse energy resource.
So, Mr. Eilers, to follow up on that, I'm not clear if I'm following what VARTW stands for. Does that actually allow you to store energy or turn it on even if the wind isn't blowing, therefore the wind turbines become more efficient in that they're producing power more than 30-40% of the time? Or am I missing the boat completely?
Well, you are missing the boat, but only because if we could make the wind turbines produce when there's no wind, boy, none of us would be here.
Well, that's what I didn't think.
Well, I think to make it simple, yeah, we are more and more like a conventional power plant in that we add stability to the grid. We can handle disturbances. DVAR helps us be able to ride through system disturbances, be able to react to the shifting voltage on a system. The dynamics of a transmission system can swing from time to time, and you want to have technology that can withstand the swings, and that's what we've designed.
Okay.
Wind power will stay on the grid through system disturbances.
Okay. Representative Thiessen. And then Representative Beard.
All right, I had a follow-up for Mr. Jewell.
Go ahead, Representative Peterson. I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the others. I just want to ask Mr. Jewell a question. Now, this bill, as you've studied it for a while, and you're quite well aware, and you've been very active in the last energy bill, and there's a provision in there that, 132-2 was the final vote for community-based energy development. Now, you're sitting next to the General Electric person, and, you know, they're talking investing in billions and billions a year, and you promoted and have been successful in getting the community-based energy development into the... They don't have to necessarily buy it from you, but you got a rate on your community-based energy development tariff. Can you, as a seabed, build the 10 megawatt, 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt, 200, 300 megawatt projects with the way the finances would be structured as in the same way or manner under the renewable energy standard timelines, you know, the 10%, 15%, 20% by 2020. Can you put those at the same rate as opposed to how the blocks of megawatts have been allocated to Florida Power and Light, General Electric in Lincoln County, and those, I guess, out-of-state operators that might not be interested in the seabed, if you will? And if over the next 5 years, under the REO, we don't kick into, under this RES bill that Representative Davis and I are talking about, it doesn't start until 2010. So we'll be under the REO now to 2010. So if the REO objectives bypass seabed projects, when you answer the question, you may or may not be able to build them, you know, as quickly and as the same as anybody else. I mean, I'm confident from what we've talked about that you'll be able to do that.
I'm just wondering, you know, under the REO, where do you see seabed fitting in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pearson, the seabed is just a component of what we can do.
Right.
And yes, we can build them just as fast and just as good. There's no doubt in my mind about that. I mean, we
just wanted on I just wanted that on the record.
Okay. We've demonstrated that we can do it. We can organize the capital. We can organize the communities. There's different models on how it can be accomplished. We've done the Blocks and Cracks like a co-op through the Minwin projects, where we've got 250 farmers and small businessmen that invest proportions into the project. We've got all the way down to where single farmers own and partner in with an equity taxpayer. So yes, we can do it, and I think that as a taxpayer and a ratepayer in the state of Minnesota, if we don't make seabed a major component in anything that we do in our energy future, we're really missing the boat, because this is such a huge economic development tool. And keeping the dollars, like Commissioner Cruz talked about, we export $4 billion a year. Well, if we can find any way possible to keep those dollars in our state and our community, we're all going to be better off. And we need the energy, and we can do that through renewables and energy efficiency.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
The the coastline between Vantage and Amperage, and it's just a power quality issue.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Pearson.
For Mr. Eilers, I just wanted to get it. You were talking about the partnership between the private and the public roles and kind of moving forward on these alternative energies. Can you talk a little bit about how you see enacting an objective or a standard plays into the decision-making that your company or some other private company would make in terms of making those investments? Can you talk a little bit more detail about that? Does that question make sense?
Well, I guess I'll interpret it. Okay. And I think some of the comments I had, we need to have certainty. And while the production tax credit provides a mechanism that subsidizes wind, it's a very volatile tool that the government has given us. We have incredible inefficiencies in our system, because if you've ever seen the growth plan of the U.S., it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. It's surprising anyone gets in the business, because steel manufacturers to gearbox manufacturers, why would they want to increase production or increase capabilities when you don't know, just by the time you finish it, there's a 9-month lag in the production tax credit. So I think an RPS or a renewable objective, it needs to have teeth. It needs to have certainty. There need to be sustained pattern growth that we know we can make a base load of turbines out there such that we can increase investment. The PTC doesn't quite get us there. So I think the portfolio standard adds certainty to our market. And it allows the mechanism of the market to play in. As was mentioned earlier, it's not just wind. We have a solar side as well. And even biodiesel in our gas turbines may be qualified. I mean, if you create a market, we'll come up with technologies. And wind will not be the only game. It will be the only game near-term because it's more cost-effective, but there will be other games in town if you create certainty in the marketplace. I hope I answered it.
You did. Thank you.
That is not good.
Mr. Chairman,
this will plow real deep. Perhaps I withhold my comments or questions for a while. So let's.
You don't want to plow?
I don't want to plow right now. No thanks.
I'll plow for you then. I'm not going to plow deep. Mr. Jewell, just a question following up on Representative Peterson's question. With seabed that passed this year, there's a lot of good faith negotiating that's got to go on between community development projects and the utilities and the players that help develop them and all that. But under a scenario where an RES didn't pass, we didn't have a firm 20% mandate, but we've got our REOs in place right now. Can seabed fulfill our REO and exceed? I mean, could we actually just continue on with the seabed that we passed this year and with good faith negotiations, earnest, serious venturing out by utility companies and wind farm development co-ops, LLCs, etc.? Could we meet
10 or 20% objective in 15 years, just with the seabed language we've got in place, assuming all the parties are there in good faith?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, good faith. Obviously, the jury's still out. I mean, we haven't had the seabed legislation on the table long enough. Xcel Energy has been working, and they've told me that they have 900 megawatts of seabed proposals on their table right now. We've met with Rick Lancaster from GRE, and they're talking about doing a seabed-based bidding process. I firmly believe that we could fill out a lot of capacity using seabed development, and then all of the economic values that come with it would be such a huge opportunity or huge value to us. Good faith is always a nice term, but the rubber has to hit the road sooner or later. And after almost 30 years in this business, I've been spun around many times on good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need to make the rubber hit the road. But given the fact that we have the seabed legislation on the table, and there is some movement, hopefully we can fulfill our objective using community-based energy development.
So the jury's still on?
Still deliberating.
Okay. Representative Powell, then we probably need to move on to the next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jewell, last year we indicated that the PUC do a wind integration study, and I'd just like to have your brief comments on that, how you think it's going, and whether that was the correct way to see how we could integrate 20% of wind into the present system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have real intimate details on how the study. Mike Michaud has been working on that integration study, and I believe they're making progress on it. But just looking at it from the standpoint of having done this for so many years and plugged in at many spots into the system, I firmly believe that like the community-based distributed generation model can fit into our system real nice. I mean, we already have a lot of wires that are running throughout this state, and we can start plugging into those wires right now without having to build hundreds of millions of dollars of transmission, and then we can look at the transmission system and see what we need to do to augment it. But the integration study itself, I believe, is going fairly well, and I don't have the details of how it's going because I don't think it's completed yet. But Mike Michaud would be the person to talk about that.
And just one follow-up comment, Mr. Chairman. They came out with their statement of work yesterday. I got this in the email. Their timeline on that integration study for the final report is November 16th of 2006. So they're going to spend time on this, and they're bringing in experts from all over the country, experts that have kind of been denigrated a little bit here this afternoon by the testifier. But there's a lot of buy-in on this. And I think we need to, as a legislature, we need to understand that we don't want to get in a situation where we're ready, fire, aim. We need to make sure that we have all our ducks in a row and make sure that we can integrate 20% renewables into our system, whether that is possible or not, because we really don't know. And that's what the study is aimed to get to. And hopefully they'll be able to come to that to a conclusion on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eilers and Mr. Jewell. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, Jerry Fallis from the steel workers. And on deck, Bob Olson and David Skilbrand from the banking community. If you guys want to come together after Jerry, that'd be great. Jerry, welcome to our committee, bank committee hearing, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Fallis. I'm a steel worker from Gilbert, Minnesota, which is on the Iron Range in northern Minnesota. It may seem kind of strange having the steel workers here supporting a renewable energy standard, but we believe renewable energy standards and jobs go hand in hand. You'll probably hear a lot of statistics in figures today, but I'd kind of like to put a face to some of these jobs. As a former president of Local 4108, which represented the employees at LTD Steel and Mining Company. I've seen the devastation that will happen when an industry you depend on fails you. There were 1,400 people lost their jobs in healthcare. A lot of these people retrained, but once they went through retraining, there just aren't enough jobs to go around. The mining industry has always been a kind of a major industry in the, on the Iron Range. Many of the workers there are second and third generation miners. They went to work in the mines right out of high school. Today, in order to get a job in the mines, you need a two-year college education or extensive training in the mining industry. Many young people are going back to school to become millwrights, mechanics, and welders. A variety of industrial trades, only to find there aren't enough jobs on the range. My own son has a four-year degree in engineering. He had to move to Minneapolis to get a job in engineering. Not that I have anything against Minneapolis, but we do need a lot more jobs in rural Minnesota. I'm sure you've all heard the numbers. In 1970, we had 15,000 steelworkers on the range. Today, we have less than 5,000. Shortly after LTD Steel Mining Company closed down, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that said that the way for the steel industry to restructure themselves is to file bankruptcy, get rid of all their legacy costs, and start all over. Well, since 2001, over 40 steel companies have filed bankruptcy. 15 steel industry pensions have been terminated. 50,000 steelworkers have lost their job, and over 250,000 steelworkers are without insurance. This year, most of the mines are operating at full capacity, but what about next year or the year after? Everybody knows how cyclical the mining industry is and how the range has to diversify. We believe with a renewable energy standard, we'd have the opportunity to do that. A study by the Union of Concerned Scientists found that with a 20% renewable energy standard by 2020, we would produce $1.7 billion in new capital investments, create over 5,000 new jobs in a manufacturing, construction, and maintenance industries. Renewable energy creates more jobs than other source of energy. Four times as many jobs per megawatt have been installed capacity as natural gas, and 40% more jobs per dollar invested in coal. Most of these jobs will be in manufacturing, a sector of the economy that has been hemorrhaging jobs since 2001. Wind energy directly employs 40,000 people in Germany. German wind industry use of steel is exceeded only by automobile manufacturing, and Germany doesn't come close to having the wind resources they do in Minnesota. Minnesota is losing all the jobs. The Spanish wind turbine manufacturer Gamesa is building a new plant in Pennsylvania, creating 1,000 new jobs over the next 5 years and $40 million in new investments. Minnesota competed for that manufacturing facility and lost. Why? Because there's a guaranteed market for those turbines. Pennsylvania has a renewable energy standard. The Iron Range has a highly skilled, dedicated workforce, abundant in natural resources just waiting for a renewable energy industry. Investments in such projects as manufacturing wind turbines, expanding biomass energy production, could open new markets and create new jobs. Could improve the quality of life and ease the pain for the uncertainty of what lays ahead for the mining industry. A recent poll showed that close to 80% of the Minnesotans, their constituents, believe in renewable energy. Renewable energy creates good jobs with a high pay and benefits. Minnesota is the Saudi Arabia of wind. A renewable energy standard just makes common sense. We urge you to support the renewable energy and House File 1561. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Fallis? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll now move on to Bob Olson and Mr. Skillbred. Do you want to come down together?
I'm Bob Olson. I'm the chairman, majority shareholder of St. Stephen State Bank in St. Cloud. I'm also a downtown Minneapolis tax and corporate attorney and live in Orono. A couple years ago, at the invitation of Great River Energy, I traveled to Chandler, Minnesota and sat through a number of their lectures about wind energy. On the way back, I took out a notebook and started jotting the numbers. And it was very, very clear that it works. Wind energy is a very, very good investment. We're looking to make a lot of loans in that area. And one of the bills, some of the language that you have in front of you today but hasn't been discussed, has me as an originator in the Senate last year. Gary Kubley introduced a bill to provide loan guarantees to banks who make loans for wind turbines. The SBA currently will guarantee 75% of the principal. We're saying that the state of Minnesota, on a revenue-neutral program, charging a 1% guarantor's fee, should provide 15% guarantee. That way the banks will have a 90% guarantee on their loans. It's not so necessary because of the risk in bank in wind-driven loans, because none of them have defaulted. In fact, down at Pipestone in June, we had a couple of presenters from two of the banks who made most of the wind loans in Minnesota, and they have not had a monthly payment late yet. And these are to the community loans to the community owners. But current regulation provides that if a bank makes a loan on a windmill, it must count it toward its single lending limit. A small bank might have $1 million lending limit or a $5 or $10 million lending limit. The unique to the wind industry is a provision or a regulatory provision written by a regulator in Kansas City that says if you make one wind loan, two wind loans, three wind loans to separate borrowers, you have to add them all together. Now, if you have an SBA guarantee against the principal, or it's secured by CDs or government securities, or a Minnesota guarantee, you don't have to count the guaranteed principal against your lending limit. Let me say a couple. So I would suggest that you give some strong consideration to that bill. Let me just talk a little bit about what I have learned. I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years looking at wind energy, and I have been convinced that there is nothing that Minnesota can do for itself economically that comes even close to developing its wind resources. And I probably couldn't find 35 people in the state of Minnesota who have more power over that than those of you in this room. I think that 100 years ago, the automobile was coming on the market, and there were those who said automobiles will never take the place of horse and buggy. I'm convinced that oil, gas, and coal are the horse and buggy of this decade. Back in 1905, there were legislators saying that we don't have a responsibility to regulate roads or automobiles. Horses can travel on it. That's good enough. I think you people in this room are kind of in that same position today. You control whether or not we advance quickly in the development of renewable energy or not. Professor Dr. Lewis Schwarzkopf, physics professor, did some numbers for us. The United States consumes about 20 million barrels of oil each year. Transferring that into joules of energy, which is a basic measure of energy, that's about 5.7 gigajoules of energy. Let me ask this question, if we discovered oil 30-35 miles each side of Interstate 90 from over past Sioux Falls, over past Rochester, Albert Lea, and there was enough oil under that land to replace all of the oil consumed in the United States each year from domestic production, from Canadian, Alaskan, Venezuelan, Mexican, Middle East imports, would we start drilling? I think the answer is obvious, yes. There is enough wind energy in that area to produce the same amount of energy.
by 0.7 gigajoules using current technology. Technology has changed substantially in the last 15, 20 years with wind energy. We would consume, if we did that, we would consume about 1% of the farmland. Now, that doesn't take care of our electrical needs. We'd still probably need western Minnesota up toward Fargo and maybe even South Dakota and North Dakota to supply the United States energy needs. That's serious stuff. Now, one of the issues is about wind energy is that it's not consistent. It's not constant. In Iceland, over in Reykjavik, Shell Oil built the first hydrogen fuel, hydrogen filling station, where they use where they fill their hydrogen fuel cell buses with hydrogen. They take the electricity created from their geothermal energy and put an anode and a cathode into a tub of water. You remember this from high school science. Off of one comes hydrogen, off the other goes oxygen. They put it in an LP tank and they fuel their hydrogen fuel cell buses, which go silently through the streets. I think that what we will see in the future, as President Bush said in a recent inaugural address, that hydrogen is the way of the future. One of the technologies that I'm convinced will be developed, I don't see the future real clearly, is the storage of hydrogen produced by electricity produced by wind turbines, so that much like natural gas is stored today, it will, when the wind isn't blowing, run gas turbines that will cleanly supply electricity. I think the hydrogen fuel cell is the way of the future, too. I have proposed, there has been a proposal, and Norm Coleman is a substantial advocate of this, that $850 million of federal loan guarantees go to build a coal plant up on the Iron Range. I know that people talk about clean coal. It's cleaner coal, but it's not clean coal. My suggestion is that we take these federal loan guarantees and use them to finance private industry to build a wind turbine manufacturing plant on the Iron Range and a second one in St. Cloud. Right now, most of our turbines come from either Denmark or Germany, Spain, India. GE is Mark's company, has an assembly plant down in Florida, but most of its parts come from Germany. It costs, as I've heard, approximately $100,000 per turbine to bring these million-dollar turbines over to Minnesota and erect them. We should be assembling them and manufacturing them here. If we had a plant in St. Cloud and one on the Iron Range, we would save $100,000 per turbine in the construction of these wind facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And we're past 8 minutes. And just to clear it up, it'd be on the Iron Range and in Preston, where the plants would be built. So just wanted to clear that up. Mr. Skillbred.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll make this very brief. David Skillbred with the Independent Community Bankers in Minnesota. Approximately 300 community-focused banks throughout Minnesota. Community-focused meanings are staffed by local people making local decisions with a local commitment. Many of our banks have been around for around 100 years and some of those more. Mr. Chairman and members, the ICBM does not have a specific position as of today on the RES. But many of the reasons that we supported Seabed last year were reasons that are coming up and I'm reminded of in the discussion today. Wind energy came on our radar screen because a number of our bankers on our IT committee looked at it as a new cash crop for our local communities. As I said, we've got bankers in communities 100 years old or more. If things go bad, we just don't pick up and go somewhere else where things are good. We stay there, we're committed to the community, and at the same time we look for new ways to strengthen that community economically. And wind energy was one of the things that we found and targeted, and since then our association has been trying to do as much educational sort of work on behalf of our members as we can so they can learn more about it and make these loans. Bob mentioned being in Pipestone on June 16th. We did an energy, a wind energy financing seminar specifically for lenders. We had nearly 50 lenders at that event. We had an all-day seminar. We started at 9 o'clock in the morning. We got done at 3 o'clock. No stops, speakers all along the way, and then had a tour of some of the turbines in that area afterward. I think what that says is that from the financing point of view, lenders and others are looking for ways to help the people that they serve and strengthen the communities that they serve as well. The seabed issue specifically was an issue that came to us last year or thereabouts. The governor's staff contacted us while that proposal was going through the legislative process, asked us to put some lenders together to take a look at that and give them some feedback. In the process of that, we gave them a thumbs up. We liked the flexibility that we hoped to see from that proposal, and we also then ended up supporting that along the way. And Chairman Westrom isn't here, but I've got a letter that we gave him last April supporting that, that I believe was used in the documents for that bill as it wound its way through the House. So that's a little history of our association, and like I said, I think that the issues before you are important, not only as policies, but for the communities and the people we serve, and we're hopeful that steps might be taken to make this a stronger economic development tool for all of those concerned. So with that, I'll try to catch you up on your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Scobar. And Mr. Olson, thank you. If you could hang around here if there's any questions for the two witnesses from committee members, Mr. Olson or Mr. Scobar. Okay, thank you so much for your testimony, gentlemen. Okay, that we'll now go to the people with concerns on the mandate. We will start out, and as I look at the list here, many of these groups have been very instrumental in promoting renewable energy, and down in southeastern Minnesota, where I'm from, we have a derelict electric cooperative that's been very aggressive in promoting renewables, and our first person to testify will be Mr. Kenneth Scavel, representing Derelict Electric Cooperative. And then the order will be Christina Pearson, Mike Franklin, Karen Hyde, and Larry Johnston, and Mike Bell. Who's he with now? Department of Commerce. Okay. He's not with us anymore? Okay. Okay. Welcome to the joint committee meeting, Mr. Scavel. You got some stuff to pass on here. So we'll be looking at Mr. Scavel, Ms. Pearson, Mike Franklin, Karen Hyde, and then the other two that we mentioned here. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be here. I have to start with an apology. I'm not used to committees quite this large, so I think I only brought about 25 handouts. You may have to share a little bit. Hopefully the committee staff can make a few extra copies after the hearing for those members that didn't get one. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, my name is Kenrick Scavel. For the record, I work for Derelict Power Cooperative. We are a G&T, Generation and Transmission Cooperative, located, headquartered, I should say, in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And we serve 25 cooperatives, 20 municipalities in the primarily in the four states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. The third slide actually shows our service territory. You can see a lot of our cooperatives are located in the western half of Wisconsin, southeastern Minnesota, northeastern Iowa, and then north northwestern Illinois. We're not a large utility. We have a total capacity of roughly 1,100 megawatts. Our average load is probably in the 700 megawatt range. We serve primarily a rural constituency with a name like Dairyland. you can probably anticipate the type of loads that we serve. We have a lot of agriculture and we've got industry. We're seeing a lot of load growth, frankly, in the ag industry through ethanol plants and those type of developments. There's been, without a doubt, growing interest in renewable energy. Dairyland is aware of that, and frankly, we've been very aggressively adding renewable energy to our portfolio. We think it's good business for Dairyland, it's good business for our members. As a cooperative, the people we serve own us, and so they're both our owners and our members. And we're seeking, perhaps in contrast to some utilities, a fairly diverse portfolio of renewables. We're working with water, with wind, with landfills, and most recently with our livestock farms. I thought it might be helpful to give you a little flavor, since we operate in four states, a little bit of a flavor of what we deal with regulatorily, and it gives you a little bit of a perspective of what the neighboring states are doing as well. For example, Wisconsin, by 2011, they have a 2.2% renewable mandate in place. I anticipate that's going to be changed. A year ago, the governor convened a task force. The recommendation coming out of the task force was for a 10% RPS by 2015. It has not been undertaken yet at the legislature, but I anticipate it will be in the not-too-distant future. Minnesota obviously has a 10% renewable energy objective by 2015. Iowa really has no mandate, per se. You must offer some type of a green power program. In other words, as a utility, you must offer to customers the ability to buy green energy. But there is no mandate on cooperatives, for example, to have a certain percentage of the portfolio come from green energy. And I want to bring that to your attention because my concluding comment will reference that. Illinois has a 15% goal by 2020, but there really were never any parameters put in place or implementation schedules. However, just recently, in the last 2 months, the largest two IOUs now in Illinois are going to be subject to a 8% renewable portfolio standard by 2013. So Illinois is also making some movement in putting in the direction of putting parameters in place. Again, just a little background about Dell in particular. We have hydroelectric that's been in place since 1951. About 22 megawatts of capacity. That's about 3% of our load comes from hydroelectric. It's a run-of-the-river facility, meaning we're not allowed to allow the lake to rise and then drain it down for peak power. It was at one time, but after close to 10 years of negotiating with the DNR for renewal of our hydroelectric license, it's now a run-of-the-river facility. We have added a fair amount of wind turbines in our district or in our service territory in the past couple of years. We initially had less than a megawatt Chandler wind farm back in 99. And then in the past 2 years, we've added about 17 megawatts of wind in Adams, Minnesota. You may be aware of Garland McNeilius and his business interest in that. We purchase our power from Garwin on a contract basis. Now, 18 megawatts probably doesn't sound a lot compared to the numbers that you're used to being hearing, but again, that's it's close to 3% of our load, and you'll probably hear that number come up again. The parameters that we're kind of going by, for example, our research institute, the Power Research Institute, recommends wind generation of about 3% of your load. You go beyond that, and then you have to start compensating based on where your wind injection is. It's not that it can't be done, it's just it makes it a little more challenging. Rural transmission lines, as you all know, is a challenge. Sometimes where the wind is, the transmission isn't, and so you have to compensate for that. For us, being able to credit the capacity is very important, and that's, again, one of the challenges of wind. a benefit, obviously, and I think it's become very obvious in recent weeks with the price of energy. Wind is not vulnerable to fuel cost increases, and you're able to lock into, if you will, the cost of production when you build. Dairyland has also been fairly aggressively pursuing landfill gas to energy facilities. One thing Dairyland is attempting to do is utilize waste streams. To be honest, it's fairly easy for us to find someone to build a wind turbine and contract with them. It's really more challenging to take existing wind streams or waste streams and make energy from them. But we think it's good policy, and it's also good for the members that we serve. We had in 1994 our first landfill gas energy project come online in Wisconsin. It's near Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It produces about 3 megawatts. The nice thing about it is it produces 3 megawatts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We don't have to worry about if it's going to be available. Again, we own the generation equipment. As a utility, we did what we thought we knew how to do. And we allowed the landfill to make the gas and collect it, which they're good at. We have a couple of more that are in development. Actually, we have 3 more landfills that we want to develop. And Wisconsin, interestingly, has even more transmission constraints than Minnesota. One of our landfill projects in Wisconsin, we had difficulty getting that agreed to by MAP because 3 megawatts, they were concerned, would overload the transmission grid at that point. 3 megawatts is, I think, equivalent to about 100 hair dryers. That's how constrained the transmission grid gets in some of our rural areas and identifies the importance of upgrading those facilities. Landfills, obviously, are limited in number. There's only about 4 in our entire service territory, and so we can only go so far with that as a renewable source. Which brings me to the slide called Contented Cows, a new fuel source. Dairyland has been very aggressive in the development of methane digesters. Again, I bring you back to our name, Dairyland Power Cooperative. We have a lot of dairy cows, a lot of swine, a lot of poultry. That means they produce a lot of waste. That waste generates methane. And again, a waste stream that we're hoping to turn an obstacle into an opportunity. As feedlots grow larger, waste management becomes an issue. We think that we can help farmers deal with that waste management and generate electricity and reduce odor and reduce weed seed issues, things like that. It's a win-win situation for everyone. And we've taken an approach of we want to be players in this, we want to partner with our dairymen, and so we're offering to our members, if you will, our member owners, a cookie-cutter design. Now, we started out at 1,000 cow dairy. We're on the learning curve. We can do multiples of that. It's going to take some time before we're able to do subsets of that. But we wanted to start with a design that we felt would economically work. In all of our renewables, we're attempting to generate the electricity at a cost that's equal to, or I should say competitive with, the cost of electricity from new coal-fired generation. That's our target. If we can produce 10 megawatts from renewables instead of 10 megawatts from coal, our members are happy. That's good for us. It's good for our members.
Mr. Scable, we're over on the time here. We'll go a little bit over because there's quite a few fewer testifiers, folks with concerns. So if you could wrap up. I hate doing this to my former senator, but sorry. And then Representative Beard has a question after you wrap up.
I'll try and focus this down. On the 7th page, I put the middle slide has the renewable resource portfolio. Notice that about 3% of our renewable comes from hydro, 2.5% from wind, 1.5 to 2.5% potentially will come from landfill gas, and our goal is about 3% on our current guidelines from methane digesters. We're taking sort of what I call a balanced approach of multiple sources of renewable energy. And we're doing it based on what makes sense for different parts of our territory. We've got good wind resources in our Minnesota territory. They're not so good in Wisconsin. We've got lots of dairy in Minnesota and Wisconsin. That's where we're going to build those types of digesters. Swine digesters have tremendous potential in Iowa. And so we want to match up renewable technology with where it makes the most sense. And the reason I bring that up is that as you wrestle with these policy discussions, I want you to also take into account flexibility for individuals and for utilities in choosing what renewable, what technology makes the most sense. Now, some will say without the mandates, the renewables won't be built. You remember I mentioned in Iowa there are no mandates for a certain percentage of renewables? Well, following the passage of the federal energy bill, and as you know, there was a production tax credit in there, and I should say partnering with that, the Iowa legislature passed some incentives this past year for wind turbines. I think it's 1 cent per kilowatt hour, a certain number of, 800 kilowatt hours or something was available. I forget the exact number. Well, the Iowa incentive, coupled with the federal incentive, I believe within about 6 weeks, there had been sufficient applications and more to apply for all of the credits that were on the table. They had applications coming in literally before the law was enacted. The point I'm making is if you put incentives on the table, if the economics work, people will build the renewables. The question becomes, do you want to use a carrot or a stick? My wife has found that that she can make me do some things, but when she incents me, it's more pleasant for both of us. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schievel, these are about cost and dispatchability. In the current configuration, everybody wants to put a generator on a pole and put a wind turbine and make electricity, which has to be sold at the moment. So we have to back it up. I think around 20 to 30% of plated wind capacity has to have some sort of backup generation somewhere, usually natural gas. You've got a lot of methane that you're working on here in your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare with natural gas? That's my first question. I have a second part to that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'm not sure I know what you mean by how does it compare with natural
gas. We see natural gas pricing was somewhere around $13 a million BTUs right now. Where is methane?
How does methane compare to natural gas, especially when you've got high natural gas like right now?
Right.
Does methane become more competitive?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beard, the way we are structuring our contracts is our goal, again, is to have the long-term contracts with the farmers, 20-year contracts, so that allows him to go get the financing and generate some energy and money.
So you're actually buying electricity from him, not methane.
We are buying the gas from him and making the electricity.
Okay.
And again, our goal is to make that electricity at cost equivalent with or competitive with the cost of new coal-fired generation. So I suppose technically you could say, without giving you numbers, that would be more competitive than the price of natural gas.
Well, that leads to my second question then.
Beard.
Is it feasible to use a landfill project or methane digesters across your service area as that backup in lieu of natural gas? Is that something you're considering? Or do you want the methane running 24/7?
Mr. Shaver.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, backup generation means that you're able to ramp the generator up and down. Our landfill projects, our manure digester projects, we intend to run them at full capacity all the time. So that means when backing up wind, we either are going to vary the output of our coal plants or we'll be varying the output of a gas turbine.
So, Mr. Stable, on that, could you turn methane into a backup source for wind and just store it temporarily when the wind's warm?
Mr. Chairman, that is feasible. It was one of the design considerations that we entered into was, do we want to store the methane gas and then burn it during peak hours, for example?
Mm-hmm.
We found it was probably not cost-effective in our initial analysis to try and store it and then vary the output. Also, from our transmission line standpoint, some of these will be on distribution cooperative lines that were not meant really for two-directional flow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to have a large pulse of electricity for a limited period of time and then smaller. You want to have more continual flow for reliability of the grid.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair. Representative. Who said that? Peter. Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the witness, you have about 1,100 megawatts capacity. On page 4, I'm just asking for what this might mean. The EPRI recommends limiting wind generation to about 3% of load. And for you, that's 20 megawatts. Is that, I guess I'd like to see that article from whoever EPRI is. Is that the Environmental Policy Research Institute?
Energy Policy Research
Institute?
Policy.
Yeah, okay, I've heard of them. I guess I'm wondering, the 3%, at what scale is that? Is that at the Dairyland scale, like the 1,000 megawatt scale, or is it recommended to be 3% of the total MAP pool, or, you know, Bonneville Power Administration mm-hmm. in the Northwest? You know, I guess I'd like to get that article and read it. So if we could follow up with that, so I could have that to read, and then wondering about the 3%. Maybe the article will just explain it. So if you could just give me the article. Mr. Scribble?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I'll follow up and try and find that article for you.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Oshamba.
I have some questions about the
Mr. Chairman and Representative Tremba.
So we have, well, I'm going to just, I didn't catch the whole question. That was the first part, Representative Tremba. I'm just going to repeat it so other people can hear.
Yeah. The methane digesters, I see there's some online in Wisconsin and some underdeveloped in Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if you already have anybody that's actually doing this. What is the contract dollar amount that's receiving by the farmer? What the longevity of the contracts? Those kinds of things. Because mm-hmm. out east, they've pretty much given up on digesters because it wasn't cost effective.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and Representative Tremba, excellent questions. We have the two dairies that are in operation, they're online. Five Star Dairy in Elk Mound, Wisconsin, and Wild Rose Dairy. We enter into 20-year contracts with the farmer with roughly a 10-year payback of his facilities. The farmer owns the digester on the facility. Dairyland owns the generator engine set, and we take care of the interconnection issues. And there's a third party that brought the technology to us, to the farmer. And we've split the responsibilities based on what we think each party does best. The farmer makes milk, takes care of the cattle, he does that. Microg brings the technology, they build the facility, the digester, and they'll actually maintain it once it's up and running. They can do that remotely with the controls. And Dairyland generates the electricity from the biogas we purchase. Again, about a 10-year payback. Total project cost is not cheap. For a 1,000-cow dairy, roughly $2.5 million for the entire facility. We have the first two online. We have three more that are under development. To be honest, we're taking a brief kind of review of what we've learned from the first two that we've built, see if we can save steps, improve design as we go into the next three, and then ultimately we have a goal of making 25 of these over roughly a 5-year period of time. Initially, the first two that are online are generating about what we anticipated, about 775 kilowatts. for 1,000 cows. It's actually not quite 2 cows per kilowatt produced. The advantage we have is our design utilizes other waste streams. For example, cooking oil, waste cooking oil, is blended in with the manure in the digestion process, and it puts out roughly twice as much methane as if you used only the dairy manure alone. And so that's one of the reasons we're able to get some efficiencies that haven't been realized before. We're getting much higher output per cow.
Thank you.
Representative Beard, then
we'll
get
move on.
So if I'm getting this right, you got a $2.5 million investment for about 775,000 watts?
Kilowatts.
Yes.
Kilowatts?
Kilowatts. 3/4 of a megawatt.
3/4 of a megawatt. I'm just comparing that to a wind generator. Of course, the difference. Okay. All right. Thank you. That helps.
This is baseload, but.
Baseload versus. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Beard,
we're hoping for roughly a 95% capacity factor versus 30 to 35% capacity factor.
So actually it is worth a little more to put that kind of money in.
It is capital intensive. And we're finding it's labor intensive to manage these projects and get them built for us as a utility. Part of that is we're on the learning curve.
Okay. Mr. Scavo, thank you for your testimony and on behalf of Dairyland Power. And it sounds like they are doing some great steps forward with renewable energy, and we do want to recognize that and commend them for that. Without a mandate, they're looking at these opportunities, so that's nice to hear.
And, Chairman, I'd like to...
Representative Ochemba. Sorry, Mr. Scavo.
I just want to ask one more question.
Go ahead.
Mrs. Gable. Do the farmers get a subsidy?
Mr. Scala.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, I know all 5 of the first digesters that have been, that are under construction or operating, they received grants through the, I'm trying to remember the number of the grant process, but they did receive some federal grants. They do qualify for, I believe it's a 0.9 cents per kilowatt hour production tax credit from the federal government. So there is some incentives and, as I said, grants that were applied to these.
And I'm just going
to
talk a little bit about what happened in Pennsylvania when the subsidies stopped. The farmers also stopped doing the methane digesters because it just didn't pay the bill. And so that's the piece that I'm concerned about, and maybe we can talk about that later.
Sure. And Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, that's obviously a concern to us because of the investment that we have with each of these facilities. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just move, I'd like to offer an invitation to both the Regulated Industries Committee and the Ag Committee that if there is a desire to tour one of the recently built digester projects, I'm certainly happy to host that. It's a pretty neat facility.
Okay. Thank you. Which that's the Wisconsin locations? Or do you have a Minnesota location, too?
Mr. Chair, we do not have any built yet in Minnesota. The closest one would be in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which frankly wouldn't be that far across the river from St. Paul.
No. Okay, thank you. Next, Christina Pearson, Royal Co-ops.
Hello. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here and present the Minnesota Blue Electric Association's thoughts and views to you today and clarify a few of the statements made earlier. For the record, my name is Christina Pearson, and I serve as a government affairs representative for the association. 45 rural distribution cooperatives and 6 generation and transmission cooperatives belong to the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, or MREA. Each distribution cooperative holds an ownership stake in one of the 6 generation and transmission cooperatives serving our state. The MREA membership resolution support renewable energy where practical, cost-effective, reliable, and technically feasible. While we wholeheartedly support renewable energy, we oppose legislation that causes higher end-use consumer costs and places additional financial pressure on rural electric cooperatives. For this reason, the members of the association oppose any renewable portfolio standard mandate. There are some technical difficulties and contradictory passages that are in the bills that that were introduced last session in regards to the RPS, but I'm going to focus on why an RPS is not needed in Minnesota. This year, the legislature and utilities supported a wind integration study contained in the 2005 Reliability and Renewable Energy Omnibus Energy Bill. And we look forward to putting the results to good use when the report is completed. We continue to strongly support the 10% renewable energy objective by 2015. After 4 years into a 15-year program, we believe that the recently passed 2001 program remains viable. The objective allows adequate flexibility and safety valves that protect our member ratepayers. The renewable energy objective provides sufficient assurance to develop a renewable energy market complete with developers and manufacturers. A 10-minute search on Google.com demonstrates that several states without a renewable portfolio standard or an REO host large and small-scale wind turbine manufacturers. So one might surmise that a renewable mandate does not guarantee the presence of a wind manufacturer in a state. Transmission availability remains the single greatest barrier to wind development. Even so, when releasing requests for proposals for renewable energy projects, not-for-profit rural electric cooperatives receive many submissions. To protect its members and do everything for the good of the whole membership, cooperatives pursue and evaluate projects on a cost-competitive basis. This protects all of our member owners, treats them fairly, and strikes a balance between reliability, affordability, and environmental sensitivity. The competitive bid process means that cooperatives can pick the cream of the crop among generation choices. Wind, methane, waste heat, geothermal, refuse-derived fuel all can fit into the mix and compete. Our generation and transmission cooperatives are going to need every bit of affordable juice that they can get, but they will each vary in the timing and type of renewables they use, just as the load factors, population growth, and geography varies across our great state. A mandate destroys the advantages that can be found in maintaining flexibility or reflect the regional preferences and decisions that are made in the elected cooperative board directors room or their experts in the system control room. The system control experts actually dislike turning on the expensive natural gas peakers during the hot summer days or cold winter days. But that is basically the only time that these natural gas peakers operate, and we rarely use them. Finally, cooperatives are working hard to meet the current RPO of 10% with as little impact on electric rates as possible. Great River Energy has committed to meeting the RPO and has filed their integrated resource plan that reflects their commitment that was filed on July 1st, and they are the largest G&T that serves the cooperatives, 28 cooperatives in Minnesota. This summer, Federated Rural Electric Association celebrated 70 years of serving Martin and Jackson counties. It is a typical cooperative with 26 employees serving 4,900 member owners. Four of those employees are shared with five surrounding southern Minnesota and northern Iowa cooperatives. Our not-for-profit cooperatives operate lean organizations that strive to return capital credits back to their members. Our not-for-profit cooperatives exist for the common good of all of our mostly rural electric cooperative members. Even though we have some irregularities to our density statewide, we only serve, on average, five members per mile of line. We do not have many members to help spread the cost of building distribution, and all expenses and increased costs make a difference. And we do hear from our rural members and co-op managers that costs make a difference. That is why the United States Congress saw fit to pass a clean energy bond alternative for cooperatives and municipals in this summer's passage of the energy bill. And this was somewhat referred to by Representative Peterson. This is our substitute for the production tax credit that is used by the rest of the electric industry. Clean energy bonds hopefully will allow rural electrics and municipals to be more involved in building partnerships and procuring renewable energy. In the past, the rules inhibited our ability to build and own renewable projects or provide financial support to those in our territories who'd like to build. Just as we await examples of whether seabed tariff projects will work, we will wait to see how the new tool for clean energy bonds will work for our industry. Up until this time, independent wind ventures could not use the cooperative model because co-ops don't pay income taxes and could not participate in the production tax credit. You have to have a passive income in order to get 1.9-cent production tax credit. Anyone, apparently, under this new legislation passed federally, can buy a clean energy bond. So Representative Yumke would be able to take advantage of this once this gets up and going. And a person, an individual, can buy these clean energy bonds. Now, there's a limit to it. The federal government has limited it to $800 million. The cooperatives were successful in getting a little amendment in there that limits, that pulls some money away that's just for smaller communities so that cities like Los Angeles and New York City didn't take the whole $800 million because they did have projects that could have taken that. But hopefully there'll be money for a variety of cities and states to take advantage of clean energy bonds. I also want to, earlier a reference was made to the Wyoming co-op law that allowed a 49% shareholder interest in a cooperative and the rest would be owned by co-op member owners. We do have that in Minnesota. It was passed 2 years ago by our legislature, but I'm unaware of any cooperative entity that has ever tried to take advantage of that. Minnesota rural electric cooperatives are proud of the fact that Minnesota enjoys some of the lowest electric rates in the nation. On our own, we have done a good job of delivering reliable, affordable, and environmentally sensitive electricity. Other states went the deregulation route, which also made it easier for them to attempt an RPS. Even after other states made this change, Minnesota continues to top the list for low-cost electricity, and that is not a position that we want to give up. In the end, we believe that rural member owners believe in a balanced approach to reliability, affordability, and environmental sensitivity. Those are key goals of our cooperative.
Christine?
Yep.
We're at 8 minutes. If you can just wrap it up.
Okay, I have about 30 seconds left.
Okay.
A mandate upsets the balance and forces rural industries, farm operators, families, and retirees served by rural cooperatives to pay for the growth and profit of individuals that are lucky enough to possess the right conditions to site generation facilities. This was the observation of rural Coloradans last fall when every rural county in the state voted against the RPS mandate proposition on their election ballot. Astute rural residents realize the danger in creating public policy that builds one rural industry at the expense of the other rural industries. Rural electric cooperatives, before it was vogue or became law, started a green pricing option. That is why we are procuring energy from innovative, efficient, and competitive projects. We did seabed before someone came up with the acronym. Generation and transmission cooperatives like Basin Electric are setting their own goals for renewable energy and making their intentions public. We want to determine and tailor renewables for what is best for the characteristics of our territories and the best ideas brought forward by our member owners, like the Trimont Wind Project that Great River Energy has. For these reasons, Minnesota already has superior conditions to draw and attract renewable development. Thank you so much for your time, and I can try to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Yumke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe a simple question, and I just don't understand it. We heard earlier that Morris at the university put up a windmill. not too long ago. I can tell you that Ridgewater College in Wilmer is going to put up a windmill, probably start construction within the year. Represent Peterson's district, Lacklaparra School has a windmill. I can tell you the Wilmer School District is considering putting up a windmill in their front yard as we're speaking right now. My question to you is, how come as a rural member owner, which I am, of the Candelaria County Co-op Electric, and I think it's similar to other co-op electrics around the state, why isn't my co-op electric putting up windmills?
We were in a position not to be inhibited from building them because it was more competitive for our member owners to do that by themselves. It has the same thing to do with why individuals couldn't form a cooperative to build a windmill, because we don't have a passive income. We don't pay income taxes. So it's easier for an entity that could take advantage of the production tax credit, because that helps make you competitive. That makes it possible. Those incentives make it possible. But we get blocked from doing that. Now, these clean energy bonds, we're not positive, but we're hoping that that will help us move forward. We could not get Congress to give us a tradable tax credit. That's what we really wanted. But we just had problems with the House Tax Committee in